Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2097. Janet, can you refresh our memory as to the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is your third meeting on House Bill 2097. It's the bill that creates an arborist license and consolidates the licensing of arborists under the Oregon Landscape Contractors Board. It establishes exam, experience, and certification requirements. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee because it does shift people that are now licensed, sometimes on both boards, but some people that are licensed by the Construction Contractors Board over to the Landscape Contractors Board. That's the reason for the referral to Ways and Means Committee. You have the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments. You don't need the Dash 1 amendments if they are the ones that deal with stump removal. They are incorporated in the Dash 2 amendments, an exemption for stump removal. The Dash 2 amendments include that change and also allow persons who remove trees in the process of clearing land for development. They would not have to be arborists. And the Dash 3 amendments are new at this meeting. They provide that an applicant for an arborist or a landscape contractor's license may take a one-time chance at passing the exam without having experience or education requirements, and that's a new concept in the Dash 3 amendments. And they also allow an exemption from either the landscape contracting and arborist licensing for persons who are employed by or and under the direct supervision of a landscape licensed contractor, because there was a kind of a catch-22 in current law that said you needed to have experience before you could get a license, but there was no way to get the experience. So that takes care of that.
That's a tough one.
Pretty limited group.
And, Mr. Chair, those are the changes in the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s. They can be adopted together. Mike Snyder's here if you have any other questions from the Landscape Contractors Board.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to take this opportunity to thank the Landscape Contractors Board for their willingness to work with me and the concerns that I had regarding this bill. The challenging of the requirements was a suggestion that I brought forward to Mr. Snyder and Mr. Cross, just simply saying, let's open this up. If people are qualified to do this, let's let them be qualified and challenge the test without requiring 3 years of a practicum or any of things of that nature. So I just wanted to, for the record, thank Mr. Snyder for his willingness to work with the committee. I think it's a good bill. All of my objections from the prior two meetings have been overcome, and I will be a yes on this bill now.
Thank you, Representative. The chair would entertain a motion to Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we add amendment 2 and 3 to 2097.
Representative Esquivel moves Dash 2 and Dash 3 to House Bill 2097. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted. Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move 2097 Dash 2 and 3, I guess it would be.
As amended.
To Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2097 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Kitts.
Just a bit of discussion, Mr. Chairman. The recommendation for the referral to Ways and Means, does it have a fiscal of over $50,000? Is that why we're sending it to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, it does shift a number of licensees from one, quite a number, 600 licensees from the Landscape Construction Contractors Board to the Landscape Contractors Board, and that's a significant shift in revenue and license fees.
Throws a wrinkle in their budget.
Both of them.
I appreciate those wrinkles.
Any other comments? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Tillman.
Aye.
Representative Colgate.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Crossland.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Let's see. I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2719. Representative Shields, you can work them right there if you want to, or you can go down front, whichever you like.
We'd appreciate you going down front.
We'd like to see you down front.
Easier target.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative from District 43. House Bill 2719 and its amendments are good for business. It's particularly good for small owner-operated and family-owned businesses in which one or two people handle every aspect of business daily operations. House Bill 2719 and its amendments dash 1 through 3 will extend the window for renewal and non-renewal of commercial liability policies, also known as general liability policies, from 30 to 45 days. Today, if an insurance company chooses to renew your policy at the anniversary date, or if it must renew at terms less favorable to you or non-renew, current statute requires 30 days notice before coverage under an existing policy expires. House Bill 2719 and its amendments will move that window to 45 days, which is a modest yet significant increase to make life just a little bit easier for business and particularly the small business person who would otherwise have to drop everything to search for a new carrier. This bill gives that business owner just a little more breathing room, and particularly in this hard insurance market, an extra 2 weeks might make all the difference in the world. My legislative assistant and I surveyed 20 states west of the Mississippi on this issue, and we found that only Utah and Oregon had a notification window under 45 days. And I believe that 45 days is a good step for Oregon business, and I'm pleased that representatives of the insurance industry work with me on this and the insurance division as well to testify in support of this idea, as well as my good friends at the Oregon Grocers Association are here to lend their support as well. And you should also know that AOI, Lisa Trussell, is also okay with this bill as well. And if I could, Mr. Chair, just run through and explain the Dash 1 through 3 amendments and what they mean. The Dash 1 amendment restores the 10 working days notice for cancellation of a policy with cause. When I asked legislative counsel to get me to the original idea of 60 days, they put that 60 days into that section inadvertently. And so the Dash 1 amendment will put it back to 10 working days, which I think is very reasonable if the person, for example, is not paying their insurance bill. The Dash 2 amendment reduces the notice requirement from 60 to 45 days, and which was the agreed upon date that we came to with all parties involved. Now, the Dash 3 amendments simply takes the 30 days on page 2, line 2, and makes that consistent with the rest of the bill at 45 days, which, again, was inadvertently left at 30 days in the original concept. So that places it at 45 days, and all of the statutes for the other states that we've noticed have that same kind of consistency. So as I've said, this bill represents a modest yet significant increase to make life just a little bit easier for business. Some of you may have noticed a recent article in the March 7th Oregonian that reported that small business owners in Oregon feel more upbeat about the supportiveness of this state's business environment than do small business owners in California and Washington. House Bill 2719 and its amendments will help us continue that trend. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. The committee should know that Representative Shields is very responsive to comments, regardless of whether you're a constituent or not, because he listened to my complaining about non-renewal on insurance, and he acted. Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Kitts.
Representative Shields, in all you've obviously been very thorough in your research to this. What is the shortest number of days that you found in your research that's currently in statute?
30 at Utah and Oregon.
That's the shortest nationwide?
That's the shortest I could find. We didn't get to all the states, but of the 20 that we surveyed.
Thank you.
Representative Holley.
Do I have to?
You don't yield.
Yes, that's right.
Well, I'll just follow up. What was the largest window that you found out of those 20 states?
A number of states had 60 days. I think there might have been one that had had 70.
Thank you.
Ribs and kits.
To follow up on that, what do you think the average of the 20 states? You don't have to answer that.
I'm pretty sure it was 45.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate that. Could we have John Powell, Sean Miller, and Dan Floyd, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Miller. I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, PCI, with the roughly 300 member companies doing business in the state of Oregon, and want to lend our support to House Bill 2719 with the amendments. I appreciate Representative Shields working with the industry, and we understand the concerns that the representative raised and would like to lend our support to the bill. I would have one question probably for Janet, and it's a question I know it was the intent of the representative to change on lines 22 and 23, restoring it to 10 working days. And I just wanted to double check. Is it okay? The whole section is deleted from. Oh, I see. You're right. I just wanted to clarify that. And so I will conclude my remarks.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Company at Liberty Northwest, doing business as North Pacific Insurance Company in Oregon. Mr. Chairman and members, we also support the bill with the amendments and would like to thank Representative Shields for contacting all of us about the bill and working with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Dan Floyd. I represent the Oregon Grocery Association. We have 235 members, operate in 1,100 member locations, and we employ over 50,000 Oregonians. I too applaud Chip Shields, or represent Chip Shields, for doing a good job on this bill. We support the bill. I think it's good for business, mainly good for small, independently owned grocers, so urge your support as well. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, if I may add, I would like to put on the record that Safeco's support of the bill as well.
Thank you. Any questions? No, thank you, gentlemen. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2719. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move in the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments, I guess, in dash 3s?
Yes. Yeah. 1, 2, and 3.
1, 2, and 3 dashes into House Bill 2719.
This Representative Shields started out with a very short bill, and he wanted to get more length into it.
I understand.
Hi, Janet.
I just wanted to say that with combining the amendments, if there's any sort of technical thing that Legislative Council finds in trying to combine them that they need to change in another reference or something, that they would be able to do that without changing any intent. Or
okay. So noted. Representative Kitts moves we adopt the dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2719. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I would move House Bill 2719 as amended to the floor with the DePasse recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2719 to the floor as amended with the DePasse recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Gilman. Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Shopler.
Excuse me.
Representative
Kitts. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Shields, carry it on the floor.
I'd be delighted to.
Thank you.
I will question you.
Okay. Which one? Let's see. One, two. 72.
We have this one guy.
Okay, so we do 27, 72 then, huh? Tell me again, Rick. Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2772, and Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, fellow representatives, 2772, I'm going to give you some history on it. I've been a realtor now for about 14 years, I guess. And since I became a realtor, it's been extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get a group policy because we're termed as independent contractors. What we're attempting here today, and the reason this hurts someone like me so badly is that I was in Southeast Asia for a year, and I have effects from Agent Orange where I'm a number 2 diabetic. And I had to go into a pool, and the excess of $500 a month for virtually no coverage with, I believe it was a $5,000 deductible that would not administer anything related to my diabetes. So, I've been working on this and thinking about this for 14 years. Now I'm in a position where we brought this forward to allow the Oregon Association of Realtors and to bring a group health policy to realtors that are licensed in the state of Oregon. This constitutes 14,000 realtors or more, plus their spouses and their families. So we're affecting a lot of people with this that have never had this in the past. The criteria for the state of Oregon is the policy must be issued to an association. Oregon Association of Realtors have been around for years. The association must have an active existence of at least 1 year. We qualify. The association must have a constitution and bylaws. We qualify. The association must have been formed for the purpose of, cannot be formed for the purpose of attaining insurance. That's real important, my fellow committee members, because some people will think that people are going to run out, start associations, or join the Association of Realtors to proceed. This, the Association of Realtors, in order to become one, you have to have 150 hours of schooling. It takes 3 months, maybe 4 or 5 months, plus it costs you a substantial amount of money to become a member. So with your schooling and everything, it's in well of excess of $1,000 to $2,000. So chances are everyone isn't going to run out to become a realtor just to get a health insurance policy. So this does pave the way. Myself and Representative Buckley paved the way for the Chambers of Commerce in the state of Oregon to provide group policies not only for their chamber staff but their members as well as the employees of those members. So we are opening the doors and trying to move forward to have affordable health coverage for all facets of our society. And this is just one of the pieces we're trying to put in place. So I'll turn this over to Jana Jarvis, whom represents the Oregon Association of Realtors, and she'll finish up on it and assume my position.
Thank you, Representative. Jana?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jana Jarvis. I'm here on behalf of our 15,000-plus members of the Oregon Association of Realtors. And we bring you House Bill 2772 here today for one simple reason, and that is because our members asked for this. I have a panel that I've brought forward today that will discuss the details of this particular proposal. And I would ask for your consideration for rebuttal time, Mr. Chair, at the conclusion of the hearing today. So on behalf of that, I'll turn that over to Jenny Pakula, who's our Deputy CEO and is kind of taking the lead on this issue.
Thank you, Jana.
Good morning, Chairman Brown and members of the committee. The Oregon Association of Realtors has initiated this legislation, House Bill 2772, because health insurance has increasingly become an issue for our members, which historically have relied on coverage from other employment sources or spousal coverage. Because our members are independent contractors, they do not have the option to get group health coverage. A week doesn't go by where myself or one of my colleagues doesn't receive a call from one of our members making inquiries about what we can do to help them gain access to health insurance. As Representative Esquivel mentioned, our association does qualify for group health insurance as defined in ORS 743522, subsection 2. Our current insurance statutes do not mandate that an insurance carrier must offer coverage to our members. Under current laws, carriers cannot underwrite our members because they can only write groups of two or more employees. This legislation will allow the carriers to write or issue health policies to small employers who employ one or more employees up to 25. As Representative Esquivel so noted, 85% of all active real estate licensees in the state are members of the Oregon Association of Realtors, and we do have over 14,000 members. To be a realtor, you must belong to the Oregon Association of Realtors. It is a professional trade association. There are extensive education and licensing requirements which must be met prior to entering the profession. House Bill 2772 will require any insurance carrier in the small group market to come to the table and provide our members with a quote. Most importantly, if we choose their quote, they will be required to offer us the same deal they offer to every other employer in the small group market. It's important to note that nearly half of the uninsured are either self-employed or work at firms with less than 25 workers. The current law allowing carriers to offer health insurance through associations and at the carrier's discretion creates the potential for bias in selectively choosing who they insure. This is arguably against Oregon law when looking at ORS 743731, which outlines the purposes of the small employer, group, and individual health insurance policy statutes. Specifically, ORS 743731, subsection 5, states the purpose is to make basic health benefit plans available to all small employers. And further, ORS 743731, subsection 8, states that an additional purpose of these statutes is to improve the efficiency and fairness of the health insurance marketplace. House Bill 2772 achieves exactly that purpose and will level the playing field and not permit the carriers to discriminate by choosing not to underwrite our small group members. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. We'll go on with, I'll take your testimony now, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ross Dwinell. I'm president of Western Benefits. We are a third-party administration company in Clackamas, and our role as a company is to help employers with their benefit plans, whether they be group or individual employers. My testimony is being given to you. I won't read that testimony, but I would like to share with you just a few key points of what House Bill 2772, I feel, does. It is in some sense revolutionary in that it's a very simple bill. It redefines what a group is. Even if carriers wanted to write association plans like this, it wouldn't be able to because groups are two or more, where this association and other associations whose members are employers with one employee are excluded from the group market. So this bill, and I'm sure you'll hear quite often, is about access to affordable health care by employers who are currently excluded from the group market. And there are qualifications for employers to participate in this program because they've got to be part of a guaranteed association, which is outlined in this bill. So the first issue is changing the current law that defines a group of two or more employees to one or more employees. That's the biggest change that this bill does. And in addition to doing that, it also allows the association and its members to access health care in a variety of ways as opposed to having only one way today or, as the vice chairman testified to, no ways today. And that is the association could form a multiple employer welfare arrangement or a group program.
and they could contract with various carriers in the state for a fully insured program, or the association can take on some of the financial risk in providing group coverage to its members. Either way, these programs would be subject to the insurance commissioner's rules and regulations. Those are really the points I wanted to make, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Any questions of these people? Representative Holby.
I have one question just in regards to the definition of small employer in this. Is this definition consistent with our other definitions of small employer in regards to insurance within the state? Do we know that?
Representative Holby, I believe that it is consistent. The big change is what I've just said, is the law currently references 2 to 25 for small group.
Right.
This would change that, and it would make it 1 to 25 small group. Otherwise, all of the small group rules and regulations would apply and stay in place.
Thank you.
Representative Kitts.
Is it currently 2 to 25 because 2 would qualify as a group and 1 would qualify as a single?
I believe when the law was passed, that was negotiated, and that it could be 1 or it could be 2 or it could be 3. Oregon could have chosen 5. You are correct. 1 is a single, and 2 is a group by current standards.
Follow up on Mike? So in reference to the good representative from Eugene's question, is 1 currently identified as a group anywhere in an ORS?
In an ORS, I don't believe so, no. That's why this bill is necessary, Representative Kitts.
And so the real estate agents work as independent contractors under Oregon statute. You know, there's a bill coming our way from the Senate that redefines somewhat what an independent contractor, what it takes to qualify. Does that have any kind of impact on this then? Or do you know, Jana, have you looked at that bill?
Mr. Chair, I'm not overly familiar with that bill yet. No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, is the bill that's coming anything to do with Blatchley, Oregon?
I think maybe that some of it started from there in light manufacturing.
Oh.
Certain things never go away in this bill. Yeah, go ahead, Jana.
Mr. Chair, we do have some Dash 2 amendments that hopefully you have received copies of, and I would like to have Jenny, if she could take a moment briefly to bring you up to speed on this.
Explain what they are. Sure.
Yeah, so she can explain this to you, and you can understand what our intention is with this particular piece of legislation.
Thank you, Chairman Brown, members of the committee. We did add under Section 2, Subsection 1, the word licensed, composed of a group of licensed individuals, and followed that with individuals or employees who associate based solely on participation in a professional trade association. We added that language so that we could make this more palatable to the insurance industry in tidying up the group, the specific group of associations that would qualify for this type of group coverage. And then we went down into Section 2, Number 2, added, notwithstanding ORS 74730, Subsection 30, which is the definition of small employer that talks about 2 or more employees up to 25, added the word members of a guaranteed association are a small employer to make it clear that our individual members, notwithstanding that definition, would qualify as a small employer. That's for clarity.
Okay. Thank you, Denny. Any questions? Representative Kitts.
The thing that comes to mind, and is, I'm going to walk through this, so where I deviate from right or correctness in this case, please stop me at that point. If in fact I am a member of the Landscape Contractors Board, equivalent to being a member of the Oregon Realtors Association, if I am a single operator under the Landscape Contractors Board, a small business owner, an employer of oneself, would that not open up a situation such as that to fall under the same definition by which you're seeking here?
Chairman Brown and Representative Kipps, that is exactly why we tidied up the language. If they are indeed a licensed independent contractor belonging to a professional trade association, yes, they would qualify for small group coverage. I don't know specifically if a landscaper is licensed or if their association would be considered a professional trade association.
I would assume that they would be for this purpose. It's just what comes to mind because it's what this committee has been dealing with in the landscape. You all heard earlier with arborist license and wonderful other things. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much. That's fine. And we're going to step out of the order a little bit. And I'm going to have a person who needs to testify before 10 and is over 100 miles away. So have Steve Doty, please. Not step out of line, step out of order. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Representative Brown, members of the committee. My name is Steve Doty. I'm an independent insurance agent and have a business in Portland. I also am here representing the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, which is an organization of independent agents. I have been a past president of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. I currently serve on the Health Insurance Reform Advisory Committee, the HIRAC Committee, which is an advisory committee to the Insurance Division. I also currently serve as chair of the Insurance Pool Governing Board for the state of Oregon. I was also intimately involved in the creation of our current statute surrounding group insurance and individual insurance that was passed as Senate Bill 152 in 1995. And so and you should know that that bill was passed as a result of some of the concerns that have been expressed here. And in my daily life, I work with individuals and groups who are struggling to try to find affordable health care. But there's a fine line between providing access to groups and individuals and just opening it up to everybody without any requirement. If we're going to maintain a stable insurance market, there has to be some limitations on how this is done. I have some serious concerns about this bill as how it would essentially guarantee issue group coverage to individuals. We only need to look to our neighbors to the north, the state of Washington, who did this about the same time we passed our legislation, who guaranteed issued insurance coverage to individuals without any qualifications, and as a result, the insurance companies left that state in droves. Currently, there are only three carriers that essentially dominate the market in the state of Washington, and there's very little competition. Our insurance market in Oregon is very stable, and there are three components to it. There's the individual market, there's the small group market, and the large group market. Current legislation, with the CHI legislation, defines small employers as being 2 to 25. And that was the decision that was made and when this current legislation was passed in 1995, because going down to one life, to one individual, this establishes an opportunity for adverse selection, where an individual could wait till they suddenly have a health condition that surfaces, and then they simply join an association, or even if they're already a member of the association, they simply at that time sign up for the health insurance. That's no different than trying to insure your car after you've had the accident, or insuring your home after it's caught on fire. The insurance industry needs some protection, or it will be unstable. There are many options right now in our current market for individuals who have trouble finding insurance coverage. First of all, there's nothing in current law that would prevent the Realtors Association or any other bona fide association from establishing a group health insurance plan. If they can convince an insurance carrier that this is a good risk, they can establish that plan and they can enroll individuals. There are association plans that do that currently. If the association has difficulty doing that, it's because of the risk factors that I've already identified. But individuals now have several good options as a result of our current legislation. The individual market in the state of Oregon functions very well. It is underwritten, which means that individuals with health problems can be denied coverage. But we have a good option in our high-risk pool. And the high-risk pool sounds worse than it is. Our high-risk pool in Oregon works very well. By law, the premiums for the high-risk pool are regulated, and so that while they are higher than most individual plans, they are, I believe the statute says they should be about 25% higher than normal. And people cannot be turned down in Oregon. We can say with pride that there is no such thing as an uninsurable Oregonian under our current legislation. Regardless of your health status, you can buy coverage. Now, it is true that that these plans do have limitations for pre-existing conditions under current law, but that's true in group and individual. So even under if a person has a health problem and wanted to enroll in a group plan under this scenario, they would have the limitation of a six-month pre-existing condition limitation, which is no worse than OMIP. So they're no better off or worse off under OMIP than they are and they would be in establishing an association. But my primary concern is that this would force carriers to ensure and guarantee associations that would ultimately be poor risk, and we would see a lot of carriers simply pull out of the C-high market and would have very few carriers left. I think we need to move very carefully if we're going to make a decision like this, because we have a pretty stable market in Oregon, and I would hate to see that ruined. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Goody. As you heard him testify, the agents are independent contractors.
Right.
If they were to form a man and wife team, both working in the industry, and they were to form an S corp or an LLC, they would be two. Would they qualify then as a group for a group plan?
Chair Brown, under current law, they would qualify if they are, in fact, employees, bona fide employees of a particular employer. They'd have to establish the unit, whether it's an LLC or whatever. If they are employees, then that's two people, and they could get a group plan guarantee issue.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, a couple questions. First of all, in the state of Washington, you say we only need to look at the state of Washington example of how to destroy the insurance market. Is the insurance market just completely destroyed in Washington?
It's certainly not competitive. I used to do a lot of business in the state of Washington, and I don't do it anymore because there you have three carriers. You have the state. You have Regents, and you have Primera and Group Health, and they control the market. And because of that, because they dominate the market, they actually do a lot of things to circumvent current federal law. They've established some association plans that actually cherry pick the market, so that they're only covering groups of five or more. And rating internally within those types of plans to exclude people with high risk. So it's forced them to do that kind of thing because they're the only ones left. Now, that legislation has since been repealed. They've recognized their mistake, and they've come back to do what we have done, and there are carriers who are now showing interest in going back into the state of Washington so they won't be selected against.
Follow up. My next question is, in the state of Washington, wasn't it just a single individual could get a group policy? Did they have to be a member of an association with licensing?
Vice Chair Esquivel, under that law, they did not have to be a member association. It was just individuals, and that is true. But even under an association plan, participation in the plan is voluntary. Just because a person is a member of an association does not require that they purchase the insurance. And so it becomes voluntary the same way as a voluntary purchasing individual insurance in a voluntary market.
Follow-up.
Okay. Now, when we talk about a single coverage for an individual versus a group, when you're a single individual, do you not pay a higher premium?
Representative Vice Chair Esquivel, actually that's a misconception in the marketplace. In most cases, individuals can buy health insurance less expensively than group plans, and the reason for that is because individual plans underwrite, and they're only insuring the most healthy risks. Now, they do age rate those, and so it's true that somebody who is age 60 would pay more than somebody age 20, but overall, an individual who is reasonably healthy can buy a health insurance policy less expensively than they can in the group market. And the reason for that is the group market takes everybody regardless of their health status. And so that factor is included in the rating model.
Call it. Jesus. But isn't the group larger with a, usually? I mean, I've worked at companies that had substantially better coverage with less money as a group when I did some title work versus a realtor that's out here paying $500, $600, $700, $800 a month because they are a single individual. That's just a fact.
Vice Chair Esquivel, I work in this business, and I see it every day, and it is a common misconception. People assume that because you have a group policy, you're paying less money. I can tell you that the largest group in the state of Oregon is the state of Oregon employees, and they have some of the most expensive insurance premiums you'll see anywhere. Group plans guarantee issue coverage, and that is a rating factor that is that affects their rates. Individual plans can exclude individuals with high risk, and so the natural result of that, they're only insuring healthy people, they're paying lower claims, and their premiums reflect that.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Doty, for being here today. Appreciate your testimony. Currently, and I don't know if you're familiar with the way realtors are able to practice. My understanding, and maybe the good vice chairman could enlighten me, if I go to real estate school and do my 150 hours, as I think you said that it takes 3 to 5 months or something of this nature, I can't go practice the business of real estate by myself anyway. Can I? Don't I have to sign up with someone else and do that for a certain amount of time? Thus, a group is formed?
Representative Kitts, I'm not an expert on how realtors do their business in terms of what, you know, how they. I'm not sure if I understand your question completely.
Maybe the vice chair could clarify for me.
Yes, when you get your. Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. When you pass your test, you have a national, you have a statewide exam. When you pass that and become a realtor, you become a broker. You have to work under a principal broker for 3 years before you have a transition into being a principal broker. In other words, it's kind of a journeyman type situation, and you must hang your license under the supervision of a principal broker.
That being said, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to go cross dialogue.
Follow up.
But I'm going to follow up with my vice chair, if I might. At that point, are you an independent contractor for those 3 years, or are you an employee of the principal broker?
You want me to?
Go ahead and answer the question so I know too.
So you know too? You're actually still, from the day you get your license, doesn't matter what you do, unless you go on a salary, you are an independent contractor, period. Doesn't matter whether you're a principal broker or whether you are a broker. You are an independent contractor unless you work for a company that pays you a salary and then you get benefits.
So it's a requirement to work for somebody else, but you're not really working for them. You are an independent contractor.
Correct. You aren't working for them. It's tough to explain. You are not working for them, but you hang your license under their supervision. You can go wherever you want, as long as you hang your license under a principal broker for your first 3 years.
Thank you. I think we've clarified that.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Doty. You mentioned that a two-person shop could form an S-corporation, and if they met the standard for being an employees, they could then qualify under current statute. Was that what your point was?
Representative Shields, yes. If they meet the current definition of a small employer, which is two or more employees working 17 and a half hours per week, a minimum of 17 and a half hours a week on 50% of the business days in the preceding year, that's the current definition in law. That is a small employer, and they can acquire group coverage.
Now, follow up here. So it seems to me that if you form this an S corporation with two people, they would be directors, the owners of the business. Does it get a little complicated when they have to try to then pay themselves salary out of that?
Representative Shields, it's It doesn't. Salary is not really the issue. It's just if there is an employer-employee relationship, that's all that's currently required. So you could have a husband and wife in a business if there are in fact employees of the business, or any kind of two people of any kind that could form this working entity where you have an owner and an employee. Now the employee would have to be a W-2 employee, not a 1099 employee. That they qualify as a group of two, and in fact, it's possible that you could do that. And even if one of those employees has other coverage through a spouse, for example, and so they don't need or want the coverage, you could exclude that person and still write the group plan for that one person. But you do have it has to begin with this group of two.
So you could have one W-2 employee and one owner,
right.
Essentially.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Doty, for traveling here today. Just to clarify something for myself, you had mentioned earlier in our testimony that the real estate association could itself buy a group plan and then provide that insurance to all its members. Is that correct?
Chair Brown, Representative Holby, under current law, there's nothing to prevent the Real Estate Association from doing just that. They could now, they could find a carrier willing to assume the risk, offer group coverage to their members, whether they're employers or whether they're self-employed individuals. There's nothing to prevent them from doing that.
And so, but at the same time, follow. Thank you. So the idea that they could also, as each individual small employers, purchase their own plans is really what they're after. And so, I mean, I'm hearing that the argument is down to whether the small employer has two people or whether they can purchase it as be a small employer with one person. And am I missing something here? Is that what the argument's boiling down to?
Chair Brown, Representative Holder, the real issue is that if we allow individuals to select to get guaranteed issue coverage at a time that is convenient for them to do it, if we create an environment that allows people to voluntarily enroll as individuals without regard to health status at a time when they choose to do it, we're setting the stage for adverse selection. One of the rules of group coverage are that the person becomes eligible when they become an employee, and they have to enroll at certain times. If they don't enroll at that time, they're not eligible to enroll. If you have an association plan that will cover individuals and allow them to enroll at the time they choose, it's just ripe for adverse selection. And that's why the carriers don't like to write association plans. And if we now force carriers to do that, then you're going to see a lot of the associations plans springing up. And I can just see the carriers' natural reaction is to just pull out of the C-high market and say that we're not going to offer health insurance to small employers anymore.
Representative Esquivel.
So what you're saying is basically what I said at the onset of this, that everyone's going to run out, they're going to get 150 hours, spend a considerable amount of time and money to become a realtor for health insurance?
Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, I don't think that the people would do that, but there are members of there's no guarantee that everybody, if you would establish this plan, there's no guarantee that you're going to insure 100% or even 75% of your association members. If those who don't enroll would wait to at a time that's convenient for them to enroll. The reason they would not enroll is probably because they're healthy and they would just as soon save the money and not buy a health insurance policy. But as soon as they discover they have a health problem, the first place they're going to go is to sign up for the health plan. Now, may be an active participating member of the association, but unless there's a requirement that you insure everyone or at least a significant percentage of that membership, then it just sets the stage for adverse selection.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming and testifying, Mr. Doty. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Could I have Tom Henry, please?
Chairman Brown.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Tom Henry. I'm from California,
your neighbor to the south.
Well, you've come a long ways.
We have an association plan much like what we propose here today. Steve Doty is a member of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters and the National Association of Health Underwriters. I have met him before. I don't think he remembers me, though. I'm a member of the California Association of Health Underwriters and the National Association of Health Underwriters. And I'm here to tell you that we have a robust insurance market in California, and we have association health plan. Everything Steve Doty said was correct. Washington did implement a program, as he described, and it did drive away insurance carriers from the state of Washington. The reason, in my opinion, that most carriers left Washington was because they opened up guaranteed health insurance plans to individuals without residency requirement. They just could move in and immediately get insurance. So not only do you have adverse selection from your current residents, but from people who might move there when they had a medical problem. And I don't believe, although I can't say categorically, I do not believe they had pre-existing conditions limitations. So while the major issue here is adverse selection, and the carriers are absolutely correct that that's a problem, there are ways to fix that. First of all, you correct that you have to join the association, you have to be licensed, and that's a process that weeds out people from simply coming on board to get health insurance. There is, as Steve mentioned, Oregon has pre-existing conditions limitations. That's another one. That would say in effect. In California, we have what's called an open enrollment period. So current members cannot come in at their whim. They can only come in during the one time per year when we have open enrollment. So that's another protection for the carriers. The individual market, now another argument is that we have an individual market in Oregon. We have one in California, of course. But the problem with that is that it's the carriers decide who they wish to take. And that who they wish to take sort of changes depending on what's going on inside the insurance company. Sometimes they're more liberal in their underwriting, and sometimes they're not. For example, a family of four in California, if one of the children had ear infections at age one to two, that child is now age five and no longer suffering ear problems, that can prevent the family from getting insurance coverage simply because there were ear infections. And there's lots of examples like that where you wouldn't expect a carrier to decline coverage for something that's relatively simple, maybe even in the distant past, yet they do, depending on whether or not they're looking to increase their profits that year, or they may become more liberal when they want to increase the number of their insureds. What this legislation will do is create an industry program that will require guaranteed issuance to professional licensed individuals who are working. Working is another way to screen. If you're full-time working, you're not sick. You're not as sick as somebody who might not be. And it would create a situation where the carriers don't get to pick and choose who they want, because they have to offer it fairly freely to everybody in this market. A few mentions were made of the high-risk pool. California has a high-risk pool, too. It's very expensive, and the coverage is not nearly as good as it would be if this bill were passed. The fear that carriers might pull out of the market, I don't believe that would happen here with these protections. I have some press releases from Kaiser and Blue Shield. They're the carriers who insure our program. Kaiser had a record year for profits in California, and Blue Shield is the fastest growing HMO in California. I do not believe that the big argument about adverse selection is strong enough to carry the day here, as long as we put these protections in. Discussion was had about groups of two. Husband and wife, father and son, it's much easier for them and a lower threshold for them to create an S corporation, put somebody on the payroll, and get coverage when one of the people becomes sick. that is adverse selection that's easier to create than joining an association. Steve Doty was correct. There is nothing to prevent an association from getting an association health plan today and based upon the Oregon market, except the carriers. The carriers may pick and choose which associations to grant that insurance to. It's totally up to them. That is not what, in my opinion, free and fair marketing as the Oregon statute would require. More fair would be to flip it around and say the association can decide when it wants to offer coverage to its membership. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Henry. You may have said this, and I didn't catch it, but in California, then, if a person gets the real estate license and joins your association, is there a time period that they must enroll in the insurance plan?
Yes, we treat them much like an employee who's newly hired. There's a window of time when they can come on the plan at open enrollment. In California, an employee can come in within 30 days of joining the plan, joining the employer firm. For the association, for our association, we chose 60 days between the 60th and 120th day, simply because it's not like a typical employer situation where you can communicate immediately to the new member. We have 150,000 realtors in California, and it's very difficult to communicate with them, so we broaden that window in negotiation with the carriers. So they're okay with that.
Representative Esquivel.
Now, is this a situation where they come in and they have 60 days, is that in the statute or is it the bylaws of the association or the agreement between the association and the insurance people?
Representative Esquivel, that is between the association and the insurance company.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Kitts?
For clarification, did you say that California is currently doing business in this the same way that Oregon is currently, by definition, from 2 to 25, or is there a group defined as one in California?
Representative Kiss, the statute is similar. In California, it's 2 to 50.
2 to 50.
It's a small group. And then there was a special amendment to our legislation to create what's called guaranteed associations. And in California, guaranteed associations can insure their members, whether they're true small groups or individual members.
So in the big state of California, that I would welcome to Oregon, by the way, in the entire state of California, dealing with this issue, is group ever defined as one?
Representative Kiss, not to my knowledge. It's groups. Group is 2 to 50 or two or more, and then there's guaranteed associations.
Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Henry, for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Brown.
Okay. Woody Outkirk, please.
Representative Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Woody Outkirk. I'm a owner broker of a real estate firm in Newport, Oregon, Lincoln County, a county of our chairman here. Thank you very much. I'm here just basically to relate my experiences in the insurance, health insurance issues. My wife was employed by the Lincoln County School District, and when I began my real estate firm, I was able to take advantage of her group rate through the Lincoln County School District. And as her retirement approached, feeling a need to continue coverage as I get older rather than let it drop and hope for the best, just let me preface that by saying that my wife and I do not take prescription drugs. We're not smokers. We really don't have a big, thick health file. We're pretty healthy people. We don't spend a lot of time going to the doctors. So I was expecting to get pretty good treatment from the insurance companies when I went out as an independent person and tried to get some sort of health plan for myself and my wife. That wasn't the case. First of all, there was no selection other than just an individual health plan. You've heard earlier that you can actually get cheaper rates. Well, that wasn't my experience, and maybe it was the fact that I live at the coast and don't have advantage of some of the metropolitan accesses. But it was my experience that to get a plan equal to the coverage that I had through my wife's group plan, I was paying as an individual almost double what we would have been paying under her plan. And as an example, when she retired, we were able to continue the group plan for a certain period of time. And we assumed the burden of the payment, but we were still covered under the Blue Cross Blue Shield group plan. That cost us approximately $900 a month. As an individual, once that began to stop, and as an individual, when I went out to try to get coverage, I had to drop vision, dental, and I had to up my deductible from $500 a month to $5,000 a month, in order to get a policy, or in order to get a payment, basically, that was similar to the one that I had under my wife's group plan. There was no access to any group plans in any way. I suppose I could form an S corporation and hire my wife and then try to take advantage of a plan like that. I'm not the type of person that tries to finagle things. I try to keep things straight ahead and represent myself as what I am. So I hope that there's some opportunity for our association to make some sort of group plan available to us.
Representative Kitch.
Just for clarification, do you think that had you filed an S-Corp and hired your wife, that it would have been representing yourself in something other than what you are currently?
Yes. In other words, my wife is retired. She's not working for me. So I would have had to generate some sort of job for her to be legitimate under an S-Corp.
Any other questions? Just for the committee's information, Woody's father, Stan Outerkirk, was a senator representing our area for a good number of years. And great job. So he comes here with a little bit of knowledge and background in the system. Thank you, Woody, for
Thanks
testifying today. Could I have Sally Roloff, Jake McCray, and Ed, how do you pronounce that, Jim?
Niebert?
Okay.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, I'll go first. And for the record, my name is Ed Niebert. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Providence Health Plan. And just by way of perspective, I worked in the mid-90s in the Oregon Insurance Commissioner's Office when most of the current health insurance reforms, as we called them then, requirements, were put in place. So I bring some perspective as to how they were created and what the balance was. I am also going to deliver to committee staff a letter that we delivered to Representative Esquivel yesterday for the record, and I'll base my comments on that. I want to just touch upon a couple of things that have come up in earlier testimony. There's been a couple of references to the Washington insurance market, its individual market, its small group market. I want to clarify something factual there. Washington did in the mid-90s declare its small group market, its small employer market, to include businesses of one, in other words, a sole proprietor. That was a big problem in their market. It did not function to serve as an employer, as a group employer, a business of one. Washington has subsequently changed that provision when they re-looked at their insurance market a couple of years ago. I think the same thing happened in Colorado recently. Another thing I want to point out, there's been talk about the need to create these association plans. There is on the books now, has been for a lot of years, association health plan requirements in the state of Oregon. There are many functioning, healthy, active association health plans in this state that the carriers at this table and others do business with. In fact, the Oregon Association of Realtors is an approved association for health insurance purposes. I don't know if they have come to terms with an insurance company to provide coverage to them, but they're qualified to do so. I think that what we're really talking about here from the big picture, and then I want to come down to some of these details where the devil usually is. What we're really talking about here at the highest level is another manifestation of the difficulties that this state and, frankly, this nation have with a fragmented health care system. We have groups of people that get coverage. We have individuals that get coverage through different avenues. We don't have a single system that serves everybody. Frankly, insurance works best, most cheaply, most soundly, when it serves the largest cross-section of the population. And what we've got in this state and in this nation is sort of a carving up of the population. And the smaller you carve it up, the more little problems begin to arise at the margins. And we're looking today at one of these marginal questions. Should we draw the line for group insurance at businesses of two versus businesses of one? That decision was made in this state in the mid-90s to draw the line at businesses of two because it was judged that a business of two functions more like a larger group, a group of 10 or 50 or 100, in that you can't start and stop a business with two real employees with sort of the snap of a finger. You can't stop and start that business when one of those employees suddenly discovers they're sick, because you can't sell insurance when somebody discovers they need it. The insurance company will go broke and the policyholders will go uncovered. So that judgment was made in the mid-90s, and what we're debating here today is should we tweak it at one of these intersections and say maybe for certain associations, associations of licensed professionals, let's allow them to function as a business of one through their association. I would say that would be okay if, in fact, there were ground rules, some of which were talked about by earlier presenters, that made that association function more like a larger group, so that the members of the association could not, any day of the week, any week of the year, raise a hand and say, oh, I haven't wanted the association insurance before now, but I want it now because I just discovered I have a health problem. You can't sell health insurance that way. If you sell health insurance based upon joining an association, and there's some ground rules about what it takes to join, when you can join the health plan, then you might be able to get that to function more like a true group. So I think I'll leave other comments to the other presenters up here. I hope that's some helpful perspective. I would be very worried that the current draft of the bill simply throws open a very wide door to say any self-employed individual could group together with their colleagues, form an association, and compel insurers to treat them like a group when, in fact, they're an aggregation of individuals. And if they behave like individuals, picking and choosing insurance when they need it, it will not work for them, it will not work for insurers, and it will not work for the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack McRae. I'm a senior vice president for LifeWise, and I also am a senior vice president for Premier Blue Cross, which is based out of Washington State, so I'm very familiar with the Washington State situation. We're concerned about the guaranteed issue aspect of it, and I'm not going to go into a lot of details, but in Washington State, in 1993, their Health Care Act was passed. Out of that, we had a short pre-existing period. We also had a situation where everything was guaranteed issued in the individual market. What this did is it led to a collapse of the marketplace itself. In the insurance rates skyrocketed, insurance experience staggered, and Blue Cross and a number of doubled our rates between 94 and 98. Our rates over doubled during that period, and we believe that's because of the guaranteed issue aspect of the individual market, and that's in the individual market. Even with this rate acceleration we had in that period of time, we lost $75 million in that in individual market due to the situation and guaranteed issue. Between late 1998 and 1999, the commercial individual market literally disintegrated. Every insurance carrier left the state except the major three that were mentioned earlier, and that's Premier, Blue Cross, Group Health, and Regions. The marketplace literally collapsed. What also created, there's over 18, in 1993, there were over 18 companies selling insurance in the individual market in 93. By 1998, there was only the three of us left. And what's also happened is, even with changes that took place in a 2000 legislation, they changed guaranteed issue into an underwriting situation. And even with the changes that have taken place, there still haven't been insurance companies attracted back to Washington State. Their experience there was so poor during this period of health care reform in 1993. In reference, there's been also some discussions pertaining to the group size of Group 2 or Group 1. Washington State last year, in the 2004 legislation, went back to a group size of 2. They did have a group size of 1, and I believe there's only one other state in the nation that has a group size of 1. I could be corrected on that, and they have a fairly long pre-existing condition. But what happened in that group size of 1 is exactly what we talked about here, that people would come in and out of the marketplace, and the loss ratios for those groups were extremely high. And so last year the legislature looked at this again. They had group size of 1 since 93, and they went back to group sizes of 2. And again, a lot of this was to attract insurance carriers back in the state, so there's more competition in the state. As mentioned earlier, we don't have a lot of competition in Washington State now, and a lot of carriers have not come back in. So I'm more than willing to respond to questions pertaining to Washington State, but I think in this case we're very concerned about this legislation and the aspect of the guaranteed issue part of the legislation.
Thank you, Jerry. Sally?
Chairman Brown and members of the committee, I'm Sally Roloff, and I'm from Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm the Director of Underwriting. We are here today in opposition of this bill for a number of reasons that have been mentioned by my colleagues. But one note that hasn't been made yet are the pools themselves that exist, the 2 to 25, the 26 to 50, as it exists today, and the members of those pools, the small employers that are participating at the rules as stated today. In those pools, the individuals have an employer-employee relationship. I would note also that their wages include the benefit package, as noted. It is a relationship with that employer that goes beyond just providing health insurance. Our concern has been voiced by my colleagues at the table that the selection issue will cause irreparable damage to that pool, that people will be allowed in and out as needed, and it will essentially leave the pool holding the bag in the end. It is our recommendation that we don't go forward with this bill in its current statute. And as Mr. Niebert noted, there is avenues today through the association process for your real estate association. Any questions?
I'm Representative Kittens.
Yeah, this question is related to your testimony. You said currently there are association plans available in Oregon. The previous testifier mentioned something about association plans in California. First question is, are the two comparable, what we provide here in Oregon versus what they provide in California as related to association plans?
Chairman Brown, Representative Kitts, I have to plead ignorance on California law or regulation regarding associations. The Oregon regulations are pretty straightforward. They don't really regulate the insurance very specifically. They do regulate the status of the association. It has to be a legitimate association that has purposes other than insurance. It's been around for a while. It treats its members the same for purposes of obtaining the insurance. But I think the crucial fact to bear in mind is that an association plan in Oregon, an association can meet all the criteria to qualify for health insurance. They have to go out and find an insurer that's willing to issue that insurance to them. Many insurers have issued many association plans. some insurers have declined to issue to some associations because primarily they're worried that, again, the members of that association are behaving like individuals within the association instead of behaving like a group.
Follow up.
That touches briefly on my second. I think Representative Esquivel did a great job of outlining the criteria by which people would qualify in his testimony. So, circling that back around, if a group, in this case the realtors, meet the criteria as outlined, maybe not meeting the group definition, which I'm having a little heartburn with, but that being said, there are no requirements, if all definitions are met, for an insurance company to provide for that. So they could meet all the definitions, go out there and shop for insurance, and still never be able to get coverage. Is that accurate?
Chairman Brown, Representative Kitts, I think that's accurate. Let me try to restate it with my understanding. It's true that an association could meet all the requirements of being eligible to receive an association health plan, because those requirements reside with the association, not with the insurer. It's the status of the association. They can then sit at a table with an insurer and say, we will run our health plan with you, Mr. Insurer, this way. If the association and the insurer can come to terms where the insurer says that would be run in a sound way that wouldn't generate anti-selection, that wouldn't generate people hopping in and out of coverage when they're sick, then they and the association can shake hands on that coverage. If they can't come to terms, the insurer will say, I'm sorry, I won't quote you coverage. This bill would say, in its broadest brush, would say, once we qualify as a guaranteed association, you can't walk away from the table. You've got to take us. You've got to take our people, even if they are eligible to jump in and out of coverage when they're sick. So I think the opportunity here is to make either today's associations or something new called a guaranteed association behave like a group, and then insurers will be glad to talk about group insurance.
Well, President Kitts.
Mr. McRae, you said any questions related to the state of Washington. Are you based in Washington?
I'm based out of Seattle.
Out of Seattle?
Mm-hmm.
East side or west side?
Oh, I'm based in Mount Lake Terrace, which is north of Seattle, about 18 miles.
Okay. I say that because I think we've met before. I worked for Congressman White back in 1998.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So I also remember, as the California gentleman remembered. The question that comes to my mind is Washington State, do they have a definition of group as we currently do, or is this 225?
The group size now after the 2000—excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, the group size after the 2004 legislative session moved to 2 to 50.
So similar to California.
But it was 1 to 50 prior to that.
Prior to that. And prior to that, was it 2 to 50?
It was prior to the 93 legislation, it was 2 to 50.
So 93 to 03, it was 1.
1 to 50, yes.
And you have data prior to 93 and then data with 03, or excuse me, 93 to 03, thus facilitating the change back the way it is from 2 to 50 in 04?
Yes. What we have data showing the loss ratios for the groups of 1, and all the loss ratios are well over 100% in the groups of 1, and that's when we approached the legislature. That's when we showed them the data, other carriers did, and we were able to change the group size back.
Not wanting to create an immense amount of work for you, would it be possible for me to obtain that same data that you provided the legislature in Washington State?
I will get it to you.
Could get it to the committee staff, and we get it for all the committee then.
I shall, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, we keep throwing Washington out here, but I'm seeing you're comparing an apple and an orange here, people. And what I mean by that is, in Washington, it was just been admitted that it was for an individual. You didn't have to be part of an association. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. In this one, do you not have to be part of a licensed association? And isn't ours patterned more towards California?
We, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we sell association members now in the state of Oregon. We have four different associations here now. Our concern with this one is the guaranteed issue aspect of it. And we don't have a concern with association memberships. But the guaranteed issue aspect where anyone could go in and out of the association, then we would have to guarantee issue. Let me, if I can give you one example of what happened, and it's, and I know this is reflected in the individual market, but it would be the same case under this guaranteed issue of an association. We received a letter from a woman who complimented us on the great maternity coverage we gave her, and she bought the maternity coverage just when she was close to delivering, and she complimented us on how we paid all her bills, how everything went well in the hospital, she got great service, and she'd like to cancel her plan. But next time she gets pregnant, she'll come back and buy our plan again. That's the type of market actions that people do. It's a very rational market action to work that way if you're an individual, but it's not how the insurance marketplace should work.
Follow up.
Under any circumstances, on any health plan, you're going to have an exception, period. Now, we have it in the Oregon Health Plan. We have it in any plan. But what I've heard here today is that it's up to the association and the insurance company to provide a step program where you can or cannot enter into this group policy, and it can be established that way. Is that correct?
Chairman Brown, Representative Esquivel, I believe that's correct, that if you qualify as an association, and many entities do, such as Chambers of Commerce, Oregon Board of Realtors, if you qualify as an association, you can go talk to insurers about writing a policy and you can come to terms.
No, but I'm saying is, if you're required to come in and bid a policy,
yes.
Now, do you not have the ability to work it with the association to where you have people coming in at a certain time or within 30 days after they become a member of that association?
Chairman Brown, Representative Esquivel, yes, that's true. The insurer and the association can set the ground rules for participation. But what is not compelled in the marketplace today is that an insurer must write any association. If they can't get consensus on the ground rules, they can part ways.
So you believe that this bill would make the insurance company have to provide the coverage, regardless they couldn't agree on price or couldn't agree on the ground rules, they still would be compelled to provide coverage.
Chairman Brown, I read this bill exactly that way. It says once the association passes certain criteria as an association, they become then classified a small employer in Oregon, and a small employer in Oregon is promised guaranteed issue of coverage from a set portfolio of products at a regulated set of rates. And so this would take the association and treat them just like the corner business that has five employees.
Thank you. You had one more question?
Yeah, I have one more question. Is that this seems to be patterned after California. In fact, I know it's been patterned after California. But to the lady from Blue Cross Blue Shield, is it not true that the individual just that was here said that you are the fastest growing HMO in California? Is that true?
I'm from the Oregon plan, Chairman Brown. We do not have an HMO product here, so I can't speak to California's product portfolio. But I think to answer your question about the difference in the 2 to 25 marketplace with guaranteed issue preset rates and products that are approved through the regulatory process, one of the concerns, again, for the small employer that participates in that plan is that you are talking about an association where we would be contracting with that association, as I understand it. The contract would be held by the association. You mentioned 14,000 eligibles, and in my mind, you are sort of supersizing, if you will, in the small group market, the clout of that one association against the rest of the people that are there. Again, because you have a membership that allows people to come in and out, at least in the current context, unlike the employer who has set prescribed hours that their employees need to work to qualify for benefits, they have a contribution towards that they are providing that coverage. it's very set in the exposure of the risk and who has it and who comes and who goes. And that is the concern, that you have a large population that is going to be entering into this market and acting like a 2 to 25 employer group, which they are not, but subject to the same rules, the same amenities that they have in the pool today. Again, you still, as Ed has mentioned earlier, have access to an association plan. And in those discussions, as our plan also covers a number of associations, those discussions between the carrier and the association are to prescribe the rules that allow a group to come into it. They treat them much like employees with an employer group. They describe what the hours are to be worked. They describe minimum contribution by the employers within that group, what the expectations are, essentially trying to get their arms around the risk, making sure that all are participating, not only just when they need the coverage, but helping to contribute to those that also need coverage.
Representative Shields.
And so what I hear you saying is that you'd be supportive of this bill if there were some restrictions on pre-existing conditions or something along those lines.
Chairman Brown, Representative Shields, I guess it would be hard for me to say supportive of this bill. I'm open to discussing how we could take today's associations or some new category of associations and establish some ground rules that both parties could be happy with. You know, whether that could be appended to this bill, I don't know, but I think that's the principle at issue here.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. My whole thing is to get more access of affordable health care to everybody, including realtors. In my experience, I was lucky enough to have good union insurance when our daughter was born. Since then, my wife was self-employed then. Since then, I've become self-employed, and since then, I've become an employer of the state, so we want to get great insurance. But, you know, I really, one of the comments that was made there, that a woman said, well, when I get pregnant, I'll come back and sign up. Look, I'm telling you right now, the vast majority of people I don't think there's people willy-nilly jumping in and out of insurance programs just because they want to save a few bucks. The vast majority of people don't have insurance, just don't have any money, can't afford it. So this idea that women are sitting out there, well, when I get pregnant, I'll go sign up for insurance, that is just simply wrong. And I'm really upset by that comment. Anyway, that's what I really wanted to say, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Sir, any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Joel Ariel.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joel Ariel, the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I came today to listen mostly because this is the kind of issue that we wrestle with on a daily basis. And I think it was a very good discussion this morning. I just want to highlight a few points for you and potentially point out a middle ground here. I start, Representative Esquivel, with support for the concept that you're trying to achieve, which is more options for more people to get insurance. I think that's what we all want. I think it's even what the insurance companies want, because it means more money to them, and as several people have testified, bigger pools, more people in the pools are the hallmark of a good insurance system. On the other hand, I do have sympathy for some of the arguments that were made about people's ability to be insured when they want to be insured, either because they don't have money or because they choose not to be insured. I would agree with you, Representative Schaffler, that most people don't sit outside the market waiting until they get sick, because most people are worried, that health being what it is, that they could get sick on a moment's notice, and they want to be ready for that. So I think if people have the ability, they will choose insurance rather than no insurance. But in today's market, they have different choices at different times, and I think that's what gets to the nub of the issue here. There are two aspects to concern about how people get into the insurance market, and we've talked to death one of them, but we really haven't talked very much about the second, and that's where I think the middle ground here may be. The part that we've talked to death is the problem of single people being able to jump in and out of insurance markets when they want to, or especially jumping in and out of the group market. And I think this bill handles that pretty well by creating some high barriers to individuals coming into the group pool on a moment's notice. Under this bill, they can't do that. They have to be part of an association. It takes a long training period and so forth. So I think that part of the issue is pretty well nailed. The second part, which was alluded to several times in the last panel, though, is even once they're inside the association, what concerns the insurers and what concerns me as the insurance regulator is how much, what their options are at that point and whether there's going to be problems because of the different choices. Most people in the real estate association, the way it exists today, will choose individual insurance because, as was pointed out by Representative Doty, unless you're older, it is cheaper to get individual insurance for yourself and for your family because they only take healthy people in the individual market. So that's what makes it cheaper. So most realtors at most times aren't going to choose to have no insurance, but they're going to choose to have individual insurance. And so when the insurers look at that larger real estate market, they say, well, this would be a great pool, 14,000 people. If we had them all, if they were all required to participate here, then we'd write that pool in a moment's notice. And under current rules, they'd be able to rate it, experience rate it, so that it would, if it turned out to be a slightly less than average pool, an older pool or something, like the state employees pool, it would cost more money. That's how it would work. But what they're concerned is it's not like the state employees pool. It's like a state employees pool where if the younger workers in the state pool could choose, gee, you know, these state premiums are pretty high. I want to cash out that and go get individual insurance for myself until I get to a certain age where the individual insurance isn't available to me. Then I'll come back into the state pool. That's not how it works in the state pool. The state pool, everybody's in. And even if you don't want to be in, if you have some other insurance, there's even some financial consequences to that for you. So it's that set of rules, what Mr. Niebert was calling the ground rules within the association, that I think need to be tweaked here. And where I think the middle ground here can be is some kind of notion. Somebody from the real estate group testified that most realtors are in a group context. They're independent contractors, and the law right now speaks about employers rather than independent contractors. I think that law could be tweaked to say, if you've got a real estate office with 2 to 25 people in it, and you meet the rules that are applicable to other small groups, i.e., if you want to come and get insurance in a small group market, then you've got to bring all or most of your employees, most of your realtors along. You can't have a situation. So like, say there's an office in Silverton that has 10 realtors in it. The insurers today would say, we'll write that as a small group if we get all 10, or they might have an 80% participation requirement. If we get 8 out of the 10, we'll write it. There's some ability to waive off if your spouse has insurance and so forth. But basically they can say, we're going to write it if we get the majority of the employees. What they don't have to do is have the office say, gee, well, 8 of us are younger and have great other insurance, so we're not covering those, but we want the 2 in this Silverton office, and then we want the 3 out of the 20 in the Canby office, and then 2 of them up in the Portland office, and we'll put those 6 people together who are the ones who can't get good individual insurance, and that's our pool. That's what concerns the insurers. So I think sitting down, we'd be happy to work on this with the different parties and saying, let's create a system in which the realtors have the same benefit of small group options that other people have. It's not going to please the realtors entirely, but it will improve on the current situation. Might be a way to work on this.
Thank you, Joel, for your testimony. Anyone questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anyone else here that wants to testify on House Bill 2772? Jana? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Again, I'm Jenny Pakula, the Deputy CEO at the Oregon Association of Realtors. Frequently I heard from the three individuals from the various carriers refer to, oh, we are able to get insurance for our members because we are a qualified association. Yes, we are a qualified association, but if we could provide this to our members, we wouldn't be here today. We cannot get an insurance carrier to come to the table to even provide us a quote, and that is why we are asking for this legislation, so that they will be mandated to do so. And yes, I also heard them mention that there are other associations that currently do offer group health plans. Yes, that's true. However, those associations' members are not independent contractors. They are businesses that have employees, such as the Home Builders Association that has contractors, various corporations that have employees. Yes, they can get policies through the association, but the distinguishing factor is that they are not independent. Their members are not independent contractors like ours. I appreciate Commissioner Arroyo's responses and comments as to how he would like to work with us. And one point I would like to counter to what he said is that he referred to the many offices with 5-6 people shops. A good majority of our members in some of the smaller communities are one-man shops. They can't even afford or choose not to have a secretary or a receptionist or an assistant. The husband-wife team concept just would not work with our members. They are all independent contractors. Most of them don't want to work in teams for various financial reasons. Some may have assistants that sort of concept would work with, but the majority do not. They are all independent contractors and do not work in teams. I think we can get around the jumping in and out comments and concerns that some of the carriers had simply with the open enrollment requirement. We are very amenable and agreeable to agreeing right up front to do open enrollment once a year. We don't have a problem with that concept. And again, Representative Escobar did point out that I think the Washington argument, which came up several times, is a moot point and should be off the table because, as previously testified to, that plan was not even remotely close to what we're proposing here. They let any individual off the street come and get coverage. We are trying to limit this to a very select group of people. We're not talking about everyone off the street, and I think that's been covered ad nauseum. So
May I interject? Ma'am, forgive me, but I wish we were talking about everybody off the street. Mm-hmm. That's really what we need to be talking about here. Forgive me.
Go ahead.
Well, thank you, Representative. And we're certainly trying to help make insurance coverage available to more people.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Representative Kitts has a question.
I'll wait till the testimony's finished.
I guess I just have one last comment. I don't really see how what we're proposing is much different than hundreds and thousands of other perhaps family-run corporations, other small groups that have 2, 3, 4, 5 employees, and perhaps they should be more concerned about those corporations. Some of those family-run corporations may indeed hire someone simply for the purpose of obtaining insurance. I really don't see any difference between what we're asking and even not just the small mom-and-pop shops, but the corporations with 100,000, 2,000 various individuals. We have a very large pool of members. Our risk pool will be spread. And, of course, we can't guarantee how many members will come on board, but if we even got 5%, 10% of our members, that's larger than most other small groups out there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be extremely brief. Some of the arguments and good arguments as to why this bill is not appropriate or good for the insurance industry were voiced back in the early 90s when this body was faced with small group reform to begin with, when you took away some of the underwriting abilities of the carriers. So the arguments have been voiced through the years, and somehow the carriers have been able to succeed and succeed fairly well with rate increases and changes to plans. However, having said that, I do also voice the carriers do have some legitimate concerns when it comes to adverse selection. That's not to be pushed away. We believe that with appropriate plan design, appropriate organizational design at the association level, you can have requirements regarding open enrollment so people can't come and go into the plan and out. That I think is a bad a bad thing and should not be allowed to happen. The other place is that the carriers don't like this association, this guaranteeing association concept, and if asked to underwrite, all they have to provide is the basic health plan, which has a 50% copay. Extremely limited, although it has $1 million benefit, but it's a very, very tight plan that currently is hardly marketed at all today. But the carriers have that right to do that. And that's all I really want to say, that it is important to have some protections, yet it's also important to open up access. This, today's environment is so much different than it was in the early 90s, and hopefully we'll be able to see your way through it.
Representative Gibbs.
Thank you. Two questions. Number one, are there no existing examples of an association with independent contractors, similar to the realtors, that currently have the coverage that you seek?
Chairman Brown and members of the committee, none that I'm aware of.
For example, the independent electrical contractors who operate as independent, you know, electricians out there, member of a larger association.
I do not know for sure, but my guess is that no, because if they could do it, then so could we. If they could find a carrier to come to the table, then we should have been able to do the same thing, and we haven't.
Follow up? Not exactly the case, because what we're seeing here is it's a case-by-case basis, because if it were applicable to them, as it is currently applicable to you, now whether or not you can find an insurance provider to provide what you're asking is a separate question. So how would this apply to, I think Representative Schaffler brings up a good point, and I'll throw out the example. You have the homeless population, the panhandler group, we'll call them, who form an association of dues at one quarter per person to join the Homeless Panhandler Association and form a group, and they set forward criteria of which qualifies, i.e. you have to be capable of holding a cardboard sign at an intersection for hours of 2 to 3 in length. They form an association. Under that association, they have set criteria by which you qualify to be a member of that association. Would they then qualify for this?
Not according to our bill, because we have inserted the licensed professional, and I don't think a homeless panhandlers association would be considered a professional trade association. I mean, perhaps that's open for
interpretation. They may make more money than your legislators.
That's a good point. Representative Schaffler.
Just for the record, not all homeless are panhandlers. I'm well aware of that. And I think my good friend from Hillsboro is too. My wife and I were both self-employed before I became an employee of the state and got this incredible, great package we have. We had
great colleagues.
Yeah, the best.
Thank you.
Essentially catastrophic health care with a $4,000 or $5,000 deductible, and we paid for our yearly whatever we needed out of pocket. Is that essentially what most of your folks do, unless they have a spouse that enjoys benefits from an employer? Is that what most of your folks do?
Yes. And one other comment I would like to point out, I believe one of the individuals on the previous panel mentioned self-insuring. We only have, although we have a large membership, we don't have enough for our risk pool, and we certainly don't have the capital requirements to self-insure. And even if we did, I mean, if there was one huge catastrophic loss, that would be it.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. May I follow up? And for the record, too, I enjoy my insurance. My insurance service, I benefit from my insurance, my family's very well covered. I don't want to beat up our insurance carriers, but clearly there's a huge problem in this country. I hope somehow all you smart people can get together and figure all this out. But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's what we're here for. Representative Escobar.
No, actually it's been an approach there, the answer.
Okay, thank you.
About the licensing.
Thank you, folks, again, for your testimony.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
And with that, committee, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2772 and let the committee know that because of some of the time restraints we're going to have, we're not going to get to 2096, and we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2604. And, Janet, can you...
Mr. Chair,
you should have been here.
House Bill 2604 is also at the request of the Oregon Association of Realtors and was sponsored by Representative Kitts. It makes a number of changes that affect the licensing of real estate and escrow agents. Two of the principal things in the bill are allowing a real estate broker associated with the
Mr.
principal.
Mr. Chair, if we could ask for a suspension of that until the room clears out. I'm having a hard time.
Okay, hang on just a minute.
Take a little recess.
Yeah, we'll stand and recess for a few minutes here, and then that'll get us.
Chair.
So glad in your favor. Oh, Jen, is Katie Gillis over here? There you go, Katie.
Oh, okay. Man, that was hilarious.
Mr. Chair.
Are you out there watching it?
House Bill 2604 was introduced at the request of the Oregon Realtors Association and was sponsored by Representative Kitts. It makes a number of changes that affect the licensing of real estate agents and escrow agents. Two of the main things it does are allow a real estate broker associated with a principal broker to create a business entity for receiving commission payments from the principal broker, and requires the real estate agency to establish a procedure to disperse disputed funds from a client's trust account to the person who delivered the funds to the broker. Mr. Chair, in Section 3 is one of the largest sections of the bill, and you'll notice that 33 separate activities are deleted that are now grounds for suspension or revocation of a real estate license by a real estate licensee. Those 33 individual items are deleted, and 12 items are would be the new grounds for dismissal under the proposed bill. I'm hoping some of the testimony is directed toward those things, because not all of the items are picked up in the new language, and several of those I mentioned in the staff measure summary. Commingling of a client and licensee money, failure to produce documentation in the licensee's possession, acting for more than one party in a transaction. But as you can see, there are a number that are picked up specifically. Mr. Chair, the other thing that in that section is that it decreases the disciplinary threshold for making a material misrepresentation by deleting the terms knowingly and negligently, but in another section raises the disciplinary threshold from negligence to gross negligence in performing a required activity. So those may be noted. Mr. Chair, I'm going to stop and let some of the testimony.
Thank you, Janet. Committee, my intentions are that we'll be out of here by 12 o'clock, and so use that as a guideline when you're asking questions. I want you to get all the information you need once, anyway, not repeatedly.
Does that mean you're tying our hands to the table?
Anyway, can I have Janet Jarvis, Matt Farmer, and Norm Webb, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jana Jarvis, representing the 15,000-plus members of the Oregon Association of Realtors. We bring an issue before you today. I want you to understand that this is an issue that has been thoroughly discussed within our organization. I think I've supplied you with a copy of the white paper that we developed a year ago outlining the issues that this bill addresses. And I wanted you also to recognize that we had a legislative conference nearly a year ago with a panel discussion where several of our members participated. It was for the benefit of our members, and the real estate commissioner participated as well. That discussion led to developing our legislative policies, which were the background for this particular piece of legislation, which has run through our government affairs committee, our executive board, and our board of directors. So it has the strength of our organization behind it. You will note today that we have several of our members here to testify in favor of this particular piece of legislation. I want you also to note that I have several members who have driven from long distances around this state to simply be here to participate and show their support for this particular piece of legislation. And we would like to request that if you have some questions for us after the testimony at the conclusion of it, that you would let us know, and we'll be happy to answer at that point in time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Baum, members of the committee. My name is Matt Farmer. I'm Associate General Counsel of the Oregon Association of Realtors. You have my written testimony. I won't go into it. Instead, let me just give you an interview of what we're trying to accomplish here and why, and perhaps answer some of your administrators' questions. What we're doing is asking the legislature for help in an ongoing evolution of the real estate industry from a sales business to a professional service business. This has been going on for about a decade. The legislature has participated along the way, starting with mandatory seller's disclosures to benefit buyers, mandatory agency disclosures so that the public will know who is representing whom. We've put the duties of realtors when they represent both buyers and sellers in statute. And finally, the last legislative session created an all-broker industry. That is, as of this July, every licensee in the state will be trained as a broker. That is not the old sales model where a broker had relatively inexperienced and untrained salespeople who tried to move his, quote, inventory of listings. Instead, what we have now is an industry of professionals representing both buyers and sellers. What has not kept up with this evolution, and what we are asking for your help today, is the regulation, especially in the area of discipline, business practices, and so on, which are still based on the old sales model. There's a number of things that we want to accomplish. Licensees are independent contractors. They often now work within within firms as teams. We think they should have the ability to form business entities as any other small business does, limited liability companies, and so on. Section 1 of our bill merely says there's nothing in license law that would prevent that. And so it simply clears up some questions about how you pay commissions to entities when the individuals are licensed. Another part of our bill is we need an efficient and speedy way to clear client trust accounts when there's a dispute over earnest money. This has no effect on who gets earnest money. What this is strictly enabling legislation to say, we need a process by which a broker can give notice to people who are fighting over earnest money, resolve this in a speedy amount of time, or we're going to, subject to whatever claims you have, return the money to whoever gave it to us. It does not affect substantive legal rights, simply where in the world this money is being held. We also have a provision regarding agency discipline that asks that the discipline be progressive rather than punitive, and put some limitations on investigative practices in the real estate agency. Mr. Webb can speak to some of his experience as an attorney in dealing with the real estate agency in this regard. A number of our members are here to speak to that issue. We also want fines, administrative fines, for failing to renew a license cleared up and made rational. Again, you will hear some testimony from members who have had experience with what we think are excessive and very unequal application of those rules, and so we have a provision to try and deal with that. Finally, and I think most importantly, and what your administrator alluded to, right now there are 33 different grounds for discipline of a real estate licensee. These have just grown up over the years, and what they are, if you look at them, are either vague standards that speak to a sales industry or grounds that are specific to business practices that may no longer exist. To give you, and what we're asking for is discipline appropriate to professional licensing. To give you an example, appraisers, very similar industry, 13 grounds for discipline. Building contractors, 11. Nurses, 10. Tax consultants, 8. These licensed industries are able to operate on a very concise group of grounds for discipline so that those licensees can understand what is demanded of them as licensees. In those professions, what is at issue, and we think what should be at issue here, is the professional behavior or conduct of the licensee, and not individual acts of mistakes in providing services. Those are civil matters. In Oregon real estate law, these matters are hopelessly confused. We are attempting to straighten them out. It is our intent here, and I will state it for the record, there is no grounds for discipline available today that will not be grounds for discipline under the changes that we've made. Conduct. See, we're beginning to talk now about conduct rather than these vague ideas of negligence and so on. The biggest provision here is in our changes, it would be in our Section 3, number 3, which says if you violate or disregard real estate license law, then you can be disciplined. That part of real estate license law that is covered is duties to clients and customers. So what that says is if you breach a duty to a client or customer, you will have violated a provision of substantive law and therefore are entitled to and should be disciplined. And we think should be disciplined. Realtors are very sensitive to the idea that there are people that out there that don't practice professional real estate, and that that should be dealt with as a licensing issue. Some of the ones mentioned, for instance, commingling of funds. Commingling of funds is covered in ORS 696-241, a specific prohibition in statute against the commingling of funds. Therefore, under number 3, that statute, violation of that statute, becomes grounds for discipline. The, quote, demand for records, there never has been in Oregon law anyway to demand records. The agency has the ability to request copies of all records under state law. That's ORS 696-280. Failure to do that, violation of law, violation of number 3, and so on down the line. The other thing, I think, and really the important one here, and I think what we need to keep our mind around, and we've been trying to help people understand this, and you can look at it in some of the documentation we've provided. This idea of negligence in real estate license law confuses two standards. Negligence in a legal sense is a lack of care in the foreseeability of harm. And that's an important concept because it says you, at the time that you're supposed to act, must anticipate the future in such a way as to avoid harm that an ordinary person in your circumstances would have seen. Negligence as used now in ORS 696-301, which is what we're amending, is dictionary negligence. That is any mistake. Mistake unrelated to cause, mistake unrelated to effect, just any mistake. For instance, a mathematical error in adding up a number that is caught and causes no error. A date on a contract that has no effect on the transaction. All of those things can and are charged underneath 301 right today. Well, so what you say? Two things are happening. One is that the industry, because it cannot predict, individual agents cannot predict because their liability is not based on foreseeability, but simply on the fact that they have made a mistake, cannot predict what may and may not be grounds for their discipline. And as a result, they try to cover everything. In your handout, the real estate license, the standard sale form now for a residential real estate transaction between ordinary people is 7 pages long and growing. It's not growing with the terms of the people's contracts. It's growing with everybody trying to cover themselves from this undefined sense of, quote, negligence floating around in the air. To that, recently we have seen buyer's agents adding their own addendums that have nothing to do with the transaction but simply full of waivers and disclaimers and warnings. To that now, we are seeing seller's agents responding with their own. So we're now seeing residential real estate transactions where the paperwork runs to 20 pages. And then we begin to see office practices and paperwork practices, file practices, and so on, that are not designed to help the client through their transaction, but are simply designed to try and protect yourself from this sort of unknowable idea of you may make a mistake. We want to shift that to if you can foresee harm, and if you look at, for instance, the way we've replaced, and again was mentioned, misrepresentation, there's no reason to say knowing or negligent misrepresentation. If in the course of your real estate activities you create the foreseeable risk of harm, then that conduct is discipline. We don't care about the label. Putting the label on it is a mistake. What we want to do is say, focus on your conduct. What is your professional conduct? Don't throw labels around like negligence and bad faith and so on. Say, what do I have to do? I have to obey the law. I have to provide the statutory duties that the law requires. I have to be careful when I make statements in the course of my real estate activities to avoid foreseeable harm. You see, it's not that we're trying to, quote, lower the bar or anything like that. We're trying to focus the real estate agency on professional conduct. One of the reasons that we know that this is very important right now is we're starting to see a dysfunction that we would never have anticipated. And that is that defense lawyers, and Mr. Webb may be able to speak to this, are now so concerned about real estate investigations tainting civil complaints. And the reason is that the real estate agency will do something like say, well, we right now have the ability to charge you with negligence, not the creation of foreseeable harm, just any mistake, comma, incompetence or untrustworthiness. So they will charge that and then prove some simple mistake that had no effect on the transaction, and then the defense or the plaintiff's lawyer will pick that up and go, look, the real estate agency found they were incompetent, untrustworthy, and negligent without ever having to prove causation or harm. This is a big problem, so big a problem that recently some private lawyers in negotiations with the real estate agency itself proposed suppressing evidence in civil cases. That is, to not allow real estate evidence gathered by the real estate agency to be used in any civil proceeding. We, as an organization, have not approved that. We wonder what in the world is driving this kind of thing, and we think the better approach here is to square away the grounds for discipline rather than saying we're going to allow these diseconomies to happen in the industry. With that, unless there are any questions.
I have one question.
Have you all examined the Oregon Real Estate Agency's response to this bill or analysis to this bill?
Yes, we've analyzed it and responded in writing.
Is that what I have here?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Schockler, I do believe that I left a response with at your office. If you don't have it, I may have one with me.
Okay.
We'll take your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Norman Webb, and I hope that what I have here to offer today is helpful to this committee. Let me give you just briefly, if I may, a little back my facts of my background. I started in real estate activities probably after I left the district attorney's office as chief deputy here in Marion County, which I served for 3.5 years. I was counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors for 17 years. I've taught probably 25,000 realtors in the educational field, and I've authored 2 books on real estate. One, Real Estate Practice in Oregon. I've got another one that's in print now. Will be out very shortly. The reason I give you a little background is because I know that your perception perhaps of me as a lawyer might be that I'm defending realtors with regard to claims that are made by the agency, and that certainly is true to some extent. But I also have had a broad background where I've been able, through my activities as far as chief deputy district attorney, to weigh the standards that one needs to have. The problem that we have today with the law as it now exists, particularly under ORS 696301, is that that statute is geared in such a manner that it's weighted very, very heavily in favor of the real estate agency and against the licensees. The reason it's weighted heavily against the licensees is because of the fact that they are able, through their claims to claim that you did anything wrong, trivial, little, incidental things that are not significant, and place somebody's license in jeopardy of being lost. And I've seen clients one after the other come in to see me that have had that situation. Well, what is the standard that I'm supposed to be able to follow? And I'm hard-pressed to answer that question, because I experience cases, and let me just give you, for example, two very quick examples. Number one, error made on an earnest money agreement. Selling price, down payment, balance type thing. Mistake made at that point. Corrected in a later document. Something that could happen to any of us, and it certainly has happened to me. You know, we've all made errors in the process. We hope that we catch them. But the real estate agency is in a posture to be able to penalize or jeopardize, and they insisted upon a reprimand for this. In fact, they usually come on stronger than that. Like the agency will come on and say, on another case that I had, and my client is in the audience I see this morning, they charged him with an error made when he got a P&D report that didn't have, pest and dry rod report, that didn't have the identification of the name of the company or the address of the company. Yet the evidence was that there was a card attached to it, a business card that did identify the company and the name. Yet that's a violation. That's negligence in the perception. Why is that possible, that can be negligence in the perception of investigators? The reason, worthy lawmakers, is that the agency staff that they have has little or no basic experience in real estate training. There's a shortfall in that area. And their perception of what is wrong or what is incorrect is subjective. In other words, what we've got is their determination. And they go through, and I know that from listening to clients that it places the fear of God in these licensees, because their whole livelihood is at stake. And what happens is that I get an auditor come in there, and they say, oh my gosh, I hope I can get through this thing. And there's a lot of trivial things that happen. And it places a tremendous burden upon them. As I remember when I went through the DA's process, and, you know, there we had pretty definable standards, you know. For example, the elements of burglary is the breaking and entering of the dwelling house of another with the intent to commit a felony therein. And yet, in our concept here in the real estate agency, those definable standards are there. I think this bill will have the effect of helping start to define that and making the scales weigh more evenly. And that's what they should do. In other words, it should be that I know the nature of the charge against. I can tell clients, and people can tell clients, what is wrong, what kind of conduct is not permissible, what kind of conduct is a violation, and what is not. Now I can't do that the way it is now, and I think this bill helps. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Could I have Donald Rist, Don McCoy, and Don Robertson?
The Dons.
Huh?
The Dons.
The Dons.
The three Dons. My brother Don. Mr. Brown and members of the commission, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I had a little incident happen this last fall.
Sir, I'll interrupt you. For the record, will you identify yourself, and we'll get it on.
Oh, okay. My name is Don Reist. I'm a real estate agent in Ashland, Oregon. I've been a licensed agent since 1977. It's 28 years. This is the first time that I've ran into any type of incident like happened to me, and it threw me for a loop. I was floored.
Thank you, sir.
Anyway, what happened, my license came up for renewal in October. The renewal was sent to the wrong address. I did not receive it, but I did discover it in December. I immediately sent it in. I received a letter dated January 7th out of the agency asking me to make a list and send in all the activity that I went through, that I was involved in during the time my license was expired. I sent that in. On January 21st, I got a letter from the agency saying they had reviewed it and that they wanted to know if I was willing to settle the matter and avoid time and expense of a hearing by a civil penalty of $10,100. I have been in the real estate business 28 years. I've never had a complaint, either with my local board or with the state. I was stunned. Anyway, I sent a response to that letter and stated that I did not feel the punishment fit the crime, that I would go ahead and have a hearing. I did give them another breakdown of the activity that had gone on, and we scheduled a hearing for February 22nd. All the time during this period when my license was expired, I have a business partner who is a licensed agent, the name of Kimberly Smith, who was with me and who signed all the listing agreements and earnest money agreements with me. Anyway, I sent a letter and told them we would go ahead and have this hearing. I also told them I really was puzzled. I couldn't see how $10,100 civil penalty was disciplining me any more than $2,000 or $2,500 would. It was a mistake. I realized by law that I'm supposed to keep track of that, but normally, the previous two times, I had gotten my renewal at my home address. I got another letter back from the agency dated February the 4th, thanking me for the letters and then asking me to send them the amount of profit that I made during that period of time. Well, actually, the profit I made, there was two listings or two sales we had that actually closed escrow, so it was around $9,000 or $9,500 that was commissioned during that period of time. I then get a letter back on February 25th stating that they had re-reviewed it and based on that they would drop the civil penalty to $1,456. So I said, well, I'll go ahead and pay that. I don't have time to go up to the hearing, and I did send a check in for $1,456.89. Last Saturday, I received another letter from the agency that says, I'm pleased to notify you that we have returned to our former method of calculating civil penalties for expired licenses, and that your proposed penalty has been reduced from $1,456.89 to $1,100. Now, I have no idea how they assessed any of these penalties. Anyway, I signed that stipulation and sent it in, and I'm supposedly I have a refund coming of $356.89. As I mentioned, I've been in the business. I have promoted education, professional standards, and everything else. This shook me. And I do think something needs to be done so that we know where we stand. And for something this minor, there was like four people that I know of in Southern Oregon that this happened to about the same time. They never got their renewal notices. And we have another couple people here, at least one, who from Medford, who's not in the four, that went through the same thing. So that's the end of mine. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Don McCoy, also out of Southern Oregon, and appreciate the opportunity to share an experience. I've come from a background of business, entrepreneur, and independent contractor for nearly 30 years, and just recently got into the real estate world. Prior to that, I had 17 years of an association that I ran with thousands and thousands of businesses that I worked with, 12 employees, which I supplied health insurance to, and also over 50 agents in the field that worked with me throughout Oregon and Northern California. And some of the members of that association encouraged me to get into real estate, Gary and Sheila Gunderson, which I did, and began to take the licensing process, which I found to be very thorough, organized, and just very well run, as I would have expected of a state agency. I took the test, and I especially appreciated it because I passed it, and just enjoyed the whole process of getting my license. And then it came time for renewal. Last October, I had met all the requirements necessary for my some 30 hours of testing, plus I exceeded that with a lot of the other schooling and whatnot that was available throughout the year. And I paid a $230 fee for that schooling and expected to be have a renewed license, have a new license given to me. And so it was some 38 days later, somewhere in that range, I realized that I didn't have a new license. And so I asked I asked the person in the front office, I said, where's this new license that I'm supposed to get? So we went down the hall, looked on the wall, and there was my license, and it showed October 31st. She said, "You're expired." I said, "No, I'm not. I passed the test. I did everything I needed to do." And so I immediately called the state. I called twice in a couple of hours, received an answering machine, left a very detailed message that I needed to discuss my license, and received no response back on that matter at all. However, someone in the front office did get through to the state on my behalf, and they said they would mail a copy of a form, a renewal form that I was supposed to be filling out. Why it couldn't be emailed, why it couldn't be faxed, I don't know. But several days later, I received the form in the mail, and first time I'd seen that form. Filled it out, had my principal broker sign it, attached my late fee, my $230 plus my $30 late fee, and overnight mailed it to the state agency. And felt that I'd pretty much met the requirements at that point by paying my late fee. And that's evidenced in some of that paperwork up there, perhaps, that you have. Then, a few days later, I received a letter that said that I may have been engaging in professional real estate activity, and if I was or wasn't, please verify that, and I may be subject to substantial civil penalties. So I took a very responsible position and recognized that I didn't pay my $230 on time. There's no doubt about that. However, I did meet all other requirements and mailed them a detailed letter explaining that. And then I received another letter thanking me for that response. However, they wanted complete transactions, quote unquote, of everything that I had done, all my real estate activity. And so at this point, the credibility in my eyes of what the state was about started to diminish greatly, because I didn't understand why I was going to have to go through all this incredible effort. So I had created a list earlier of all my transactions that I was paid for during that time, and I sent it to them again with another letter explaining in more detail what happened, what the decision was, and what level of negligence I felt I was under. And please just give me one of these letters of reprimand or just let it go, but don't put my name in lights and make an issue out of it before my colleagues. I'm a brand new agent trying to get a business off the ground here. I've got a lot going, and this was not such a serious matter that I have to be pounded on for. So the next letter came in, said that I owed $3,670.31. So that pretty much did it, and I got legal counsel, and also talked to Matt Farmer, and they all suggested that I definitely go for a informal hearing, which I did, and spent some time with Becky Osborne, and it was a very cordial meeting. She was very firm in her resolve that I either needed to pay the fine or move on to a formal hearing. And I couldn't understand at that point. I fully expected that I should receive a letter of reprimand or the whole thing would just be waived under the conditions. I did not see any level of negligence here that harmed anybody, except the bottom line was I didn't get my $230 in on time. And so I in our communication, the communication was at a level where she was explaining to me the challenges the state has in trying to come up with ways to resolve these situations. And I felt compelled to give her ideas. So I did the best I could there with what I had, gave her some suggestions. I even included some in my letter on how the state could, if there was truly in their best intent and in their best desire to have licensees get their licenses in on time, then why don't we have some notices coming in? You know, where was my cancellation letter since I didn't? I mean, all these kinds of concerns came up. So to date, I received a message from Mrs. Osborne earlier this week letting me know she was firing out a letter to reduce the fine to $600, and she did. She got it to me by yesterday. I had it faxed up, and it's included in my packet. And I still question, under the circumstances, under my testimony to them in writing and in person, how it is that it is such a stringent fine when I paid their $30 fine, and I met all other requirements, and then some, to be relicensed. And my final thought on that is that after I took my 30 hours, I really felt even more capable, more competent, and more knowledgeable as an agent. I passed with a 95% score. It felt really good, and I was going right into the field with even that much more confidence that I was a good agent. And then to have this happen, and some of the experiences I've had in my past through the years with business, I feel like we can do a little bit better with the state agency as holding credibility in how they deal with these kinds of things. And that's my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. McCoy. Mr. Robertson, and if we're going to get everyone in here within the next 20 minutes, we're going to have to summarize your testimony more. If you could, please.
You bet. Chairman Brown, members of the committee, my name is Don Robertson. I am a licensed real estate broker in Lebanon. I've been licensed for 15 years. I own the company with a partner. And my presence here today is not to point fingers or to embarrass anybody, but simply to point out some of the inequities and the inconsistencies that's currently in the rules as far as the discipline. My story this morning is a little bit different than the previous two, and in fact, I'm starting to see a pattern here. We all have the same name as Dawn. I'm considering changing mine, but we'll handle that later. My issue originated in 2000. My partner and another agent in my firm had sold us a small house in Sile. It closed. A young couple moved in. As they moved in, they noticed that where the washer and dryer had once sat, it appeared to be some dry rot. They felt that that was supposed to have been fixed, and in fact it had been represented by the seller that it was fixed prior to our involvement. The house was listed or offered as a for sale by owner before we became involved, and in fact the buyer was introduced to the seller prior to our involvement. They went to an attorney, said that we would like to have this problem taken care of. The attorney immediately suggested that they contact the real estate agency, and a claim or a case was opened at that point. The investigator came to our office and began the investigation process. During the course of that investigation, the one allegation blossomed into 19 allegations, covering all three of us. I was included because I was the principal broker, the administrative broker over the real estate sales. The investigation included a number of things, just to name a few, included some threats, recorded phone interviews without our knowledge, altered transcripts. There were some made-up rules, basically because the investigator was acting upon some opinions that became rules, or at least we were judged in that respect. The facts that was borne out in the testimony was ignored in the fact-finding. In fact, even some of the testimony was discounted by the complainants. We asked for a copy of the appraisal several times and told it wasn't available until the moment that we sat down at the settlement hearing and suddenly the appraisal was in the file and had been in the file all the time. Some issues in the appraisal exonerated and helped us, or helped the investigators understand our position. Could have easily been pointed out long before we got to that. And by the way, when we received our notice of that the case had been opened, it came with a settlement of 6 month suspension. The alleged allegations was that we should have known that the pest and dry rot issue was still there, and we should have known that it would be taken care of. We didn't, of course, because it was hidden from us. The inspector and the repair person was involved before our involvement and had actually signed a letter of completion that he had repaired all of it when in fact he didn't. And it was interesting that throughout this investigation, that person was never brought up on charges. He was interviewed once and just kind of shrugged his shoulder and says, I didn't have any involvement there. I did what I was supposed to do. And that was the total extent of his involvement in this investigation. The real problem that we had with this, the same person, the investigator, was the fact gatherer, interviewed all of the parties, determined the penalties for all parties, pled the case to the deputy commissioner, and then, once it was completed, wrote the final letter of decision. So in other words, the investigator was the judge, jury, and the executioner throughout the whole process, the one person. I don't know of that case or that circumstance, that instance, in any other walk of life. I've never come in contact with that before. Once we went to the settlement hearing, or once we received the letter of settlement, we said, no, we're not interested in a six-month suspension. We didn't do anything wrong here. We received another letter from the agency at that point and said, okay, you had your chance. We are now going to revoke your license. We will put you out of business, and you will never do real estate in the state of Oregon again. This was without our involvement in this practice. We had no meetings with the real estate agency at this point. We had received interviews with the investigator, and we had received two letters. And that was it. So now we're faced with a revocation. This drug on for, oh goodness, months. And I'm here to tell you that my partner and the agent that was involved in this issue today are deathly afraid of the real estate agency. One of them is a single mother. I can't tell you the number of times she sat at my desk with tears running down her cheek and saying, what am I to do? I'm a single mother. If they take my license away, how am I going to support myself? She was scared to death. And she was scared to death for a good year before this was settled. My partner was a very similar, although she's much more reserved, was scared to death. And today, like I said, both of them, quite honestly, doesn't want to have anything to do with the real estate agency, and I can certainly understand that. Once the investigation was completed and we had the informal settlement hearing, we were tickled to death to these 19 allegations all went away, with the exception of one very insignificant one, and we all had the understanding that, well, since this was such a big deal, we can't just let you walk away. We've got to do something here. So they got a slap on the wrist and a warning letter in their file. My revocation was completely exonerated, and I was sent away as with no involvement. However, I found out later that when I received the letter from the investigator wrapping up the case, I also found out that that was going to be a permanent mark on my record. Although I was totally exonerated, I now have this letter in my file that is a mark against me. And there's nothing, and I've investigated this, there's nothing I can do to get that letter out of my file. It's there permanently, although I didn't do anything wrong. The letter that I received, the letter that is in the file, I have with me today, and it is worded in such a manner that said, we all know you were guilty, but we let you off this time. And that's what anybody in the future will see. That's my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
I have one quick thing.
Certainly.
Now that this has happened to Don and I, our name is going to go out throughout the state in the Oregon Real Estate Magazine as committing an offense against the state, which we don't feel was totally our fault. But people that we do business with in Portland, Eugene, that we do referrals with and receive referral from, are going to sit there and question, hey, what's going on with them? And quite frankly, I've worked 28 years to maintain a terrific reputation for not only me, but for the company I work with. And I just think it's wrong for that to happen.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Could I have John Zupan and Art Kigler?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm John Zupan. I'm from Medford. I'm also a member of the Real Estate Agency Board. I'll make this real brief. I'll cut it down due to time. As a member of the board, I get calls from agents, brokers around the state, primarily Southern Oregon, that are either under investigation or have been found guilty of a violation. And the one common thread they seem to have is the investigator piles on up front and threatens them with everything, scares the heck out of them, and then if they will stipulate that they're guilty to a lesser charge, they will back off if they will do that instead of going to a hearing. And we have discussed this. The other problem is there's a lack of consistency between the investigators. One investigator will see this is a problem. Another one sees this is a problem. They don't look at it the same way. We've discussed this at the board, and I think part of the problem is that when House Bill 2525, which replaced the commissioner with a hearings officer, was put into effect, not that it's a bad bill or anything, but the commissioner became the officer to hear appeals. As a result, he cannot get involved in the investigations or know what's going on in case there's an appeal down the road. And I think what it's creating is the investigation arm of the agency is out here acting on its own without maybe direct supervision of the commissioner on how to deal with this, whereas the commissioner is really the only person in the agency that has the real estate experience necessary to know what the standards of practice are and so forth. So for that reason, I think we probably need this legislation to get rid of the personalities of the investigator, have some firm rules, and try and get some type of consistency across the state. Thank you. That's my testimony.
Thank you.
Chairman Brown, members of the hearing body, my name's Art Kegler. I'm a broker from over in Eastern Oregon, having offices in Hermiston and Boardman, and an agent in Arlington, small town stuff. But I also, as John mentioned, serve on the board of the agency. Also serve on the executive committee and the board of directors of the Oregon Association of Realtors, and I chair the Government Affairs Committee, which guides the legislation for them. I only want to tell you that this legislation was first originated back 11 months ago when we had a legislative agenda down in Eugene. We had 250 realtors there, and at that time they chose to forward this concept to the Government Affairs Committee. The Government Affairs Committee then worked on the concept and ultimately referred it up to the Executive Committee of the Oregon Association of Realtors and from there to the Board of Directors. This concept and the ideas involved in it have been around and have been present for 11 months on the floor and to the Board of Directors. And all I want to say is that we present it now as a necessity for our industry to take care and correct some of the problems we have. I'll be brief and leave it there unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Is it Dar Kuchercock?
David.
David, okay. And then Rich Harris, please. I apologize for butchering the name.
I've learned to answer to anything, Mr. Chairman.
I just call you for dinner.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I too will try to keep my comments very brief. I am one of three principal brokers for a large brokerage in the Portland area, REMAX Equity Group. We have about 950 agents here in Oregon, another couple hundred up in Washington. I'm past president of the Portland Metro Association, past president of OAR, and I have just a couple comments I'm going to summarize, and I would like to preface my comments by saying that I have a great deal of respect for the commissioner, for Becky Osborne, and I've become acquainted with a number of the investigators. With as many agents as I have and some 18,000 transactions we closed last year, I have some occasion to meet with these folks and to deal with clients who have some difficulties. My primary responsibility in my large company is dispute resolution and risk management, so I deal with everything that comes up in all these transactions where there's a problem. My major concern that I want to focus on today is that the complexity of these rules, the process of investigation is lengthy and difficult, and it's so lengthy and difficult that I think it takes away from the effect of the ultimate resolution. I met with one of the investigators a day before yesterday, Wednesday, on a matter that was being investigated. It was a very simple, single-issue complaint. It has been in the works for 13 months and has not been completed yet. It still has a month or two to go before it's finally completed. I believe my agent will be completely exonerated, and yet, given a simple, fact-based sort of a response to this complaint, we are 13, 14, probably 15 months into before we get a resolution. Another instance with a couple of former licensees that I had has been in the works for about 18 months. These folks, upon their departure from my company, matters came to light that I felt were just indicated bad faith, in fact, dishonesty in their practice of real estate. I turned these folks in complete with a substantial file of documentation. It sat in place somewhere in the agency for some 5 or 6 months, as I recall, and it wasn't until I noticed that one of the folks had been approved for a principal broker's license that I called and made management there aware of my real concerns about these kind of activities that were going on and the approval of this person for a principal broker's license, that it was moved to the front burner. And now, approximately 18 months into it, several licenses that have been implicated in these problems have been suspended. Two revocations are pending, subject to hearings, and so on. As a principal broker of a large company, I want to address primarily Section 5, Areas 1 and 2, and my summary would be that we do not have a consistent process. Investigators follow their own guidelines and processes and procedures without defined standards. As a result, brokers often do not trust the system. I think you've heard that today already. The grounds for discipline seem to be confusing, redundant, lengthy, and leave too much room for individual interpretation. Rather than simply gather facts, the investigators also evaluate and recommend disciplinary action. These activities should be separated. At times, the investigator's early sense of the licensee's guilt colors the investigation and drives a search for evidence of guilt. And then down in the area of progressive discipline, paragraphs 3 and 4 of Section 5, I think it's been noted earlier that this section does accept out matters of gross negligence, dishonesty, fraud, or significant monetary loss, but the intent is to streamline the process of handling the most common errors and oversights of licensees, saving the agency time and allow the agency to respond, spend more time on the more serious violations. Licensees, as a result, would have more faith and confidence that they'll be treated fairly and equitably, and the consuming public would have a better understanding of the agency's disciplinary hierarchy and more accurate expectations. My objective as a broker with lots of licensees I'm responsible for would be first to have a clear and straightforward regulatory environment in which to do business, fair to both consumers and licensees, to have a system of prioritizing complaints within the agency to give the highest priority, the most amount of time to those most serious complaints, to have a well-defined, consistent, and fair investigative process governed by a set of standards of practice that are consistent. Focus the intent of discipline for minor infractions on education rather than discipline, get a truly bad player out of the business, the sooner the better. And finally, to have a cooperative and collaborative relationship with the agency and the realtor organizations and the brokers and those consumer interests with the objective of accomplishing the other things I've mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Well, go ahead, sir, and we'll take yours now.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, my name is Rick Harris. I'm a broker from Ashland, Oregon. I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm a nationally certified professional standards trainer for our organization. Oregonians want a well-regulated, well-educated, and highly professional real estate industry. The Oregon Association of Realtors has consistently led the way in modernizing regulation, providing quality education, and amongst our 15,000 members, providing and promoting the highest ethical and professional standards. We have a national code of ethics that we adhere to, unlike many industries. We believe it. We think it's important. We want a good industry. House Bill 2604 is designed to bring consistency, objectivity, and principally, understandability to the regulatory process. It's my strong belief that our members want to know what the rules are and to follow them. And you've heard that from the people testifying today. The trouble is, they don't understand the rules, they don't have confidence in the fairness of the system, and out of self-preservation, they're constructing models that aren't actually in their clients' best interest to try to conform to the regulatory process. You'll hear that no one knew about our legislation. We've been working on this for more than 2 years. We've had legislative conferences at which members of the agency were on panels. We've had white papers. We've been talking about improving the regulatory process for a long time. You'll hear that our bill is about to lower the standard or lower the bar about standards in our business practice, and nothing could be further from the truth. Clear and understandable regulations will be easier for us to follow and certainly easier to enforce. The public will be better served by regulation that's easier for them to understand, and as Dave pointed out, will get the truly bad apples out of our business. You'll hear that restructuring of the standards of disciplinary action takes away needed tools from investigators. In fact, House Bill 2604 clarifies the standards, removes the redundancies, and allows investigators to focus on finding fact and not on proving preconceived notions of guilt. You'll hear that the provisions of our bill can be dealt with in administrative rule or through policies of personnel, but both the consumer and our industry need regulation and discipline that aren't subject to the vagaries of personality, that are clearly defined, that are consistent, objective, and progressive. House Bill 2604 is good for consumers, it's good for the public, it's good for our industry, and we urge you to support it and pass it. Thank you for your time.
Representative Kitts.
Very briefly, Dave, I'm wondering, you have a unique situation. You do business both in Oregon and Washington State. I'm wondering if you can just summarize in the very short time that we have, maybe just a few of the differences between the two and the relationships with the commissioner in comparison.
Thank you for letting me battle my question out.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kitts, I have to qualify my answer by saying my experience in Washington has been Southwest Washington, basically Vancouver, Clark County, Cowlitz County, and so on. But I will say that for every, I am responding on a weekly basis to some issue with the Oregon Real Estate Agency. In the 4 years that I've been in this role, I've responded once or twice to the Washington Real Estate Commission Department of Licensing there in Washington. So our agency has a much stronger consumer advocacy role than certainly is adopted in Washington.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Can I have Ralph Groner, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm bringing my staff member, Tim Fowle, with me, if you don't mind. just somebody got to predate their experience. My only experience was when I used to run for office. I could never understand why the realtors opposed me when, in fact, Thousand Friends of Oregon sued me personally more than anyone in Oregon for a 99% non-farm use, which I think you still ought to have. But that, they didn't like me then, and they probably won't like me now, but I was popular until I got here, so I'm going to have a few problems. I apologize ahead of time.
Is that the reason you're not identifying yourself with the rest
I said
of
Ralph Gruner. Yeah, that's probably a good idea, Mr. Chair. Ralph Gruner would ask me, those of you who are new, that's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I'm not an expert at all on the real estate commissioner's office. However, my concern, to oversimplify it, is sections 3 and 5. I've listened to very talented, more talented than I, brokers who have businesses, and I respect them. However, as I look at those two sections, the one thing I would hope you'll make sure doesn't happen, because I know you will, is that we aren't in fact going the other way. This helps get the bad apple out. I happen to have met with my real estate commissioner and members, and the fact they view it as just the opposite. So that's my concern, is the really negligent. I heard some folks testify here that I'd support. And if I were still a county commissioner, they came in front of me, I'd just say, staff, you're wrong. And I was a nasty guy when it came to that, and I still am. But I can tell you that what I'm really concerned with are those who abscond with hundreds of thousands of dollars, a really bad apple. And we've asked the real estate industry to be here today. I represent, of course, the employees. That's why sometimes people get mad at me, because I have all the regulatory agencies in Salem and public safety. Mary has, and they're a bit more popular than the regulatory agencies, so I apologize up front. But I would say that we try to be fair, and if we're going to try to get the bad apple with House Bill 2604, I'm particularly hopeful that you'll spend the time possibly listening to some consumers who've had some terrible problems, and not just go forward with a day where you hear this side. And by the way, I do respect the industry. They're wonderful. Economic development. We like the tax dollars created to pay for our members' jobs over here. But I would say to you that it's not all one-sided. And I heard the lawyer say, my background also, hold it, we have to have a balance. If we're overbalanced one way or another, we need to solve that. It's your role. I perceive those sections as possibly tilting the balance. Not so much concerned with minor things. Those should be resolved in a really reasonable fashion. But major cases I am concerned about for the public, not making it harder, not telling them you have to put that in writing. If that, in fact, is the case, you ought to be able to complain if you're 86 years old or whatever and say, I got a problem, you know, that kind of how I talk, kind of slow and talks loud. So I just would appeal to you to please don't just judge everything you've heard today, because other folks maybe will want to come in and testify with some of the wrongs that have occurred, and that's why we have a real estate agency. I brought Tim Fowle out of his sick bed over because he handles the staff that is being possibly misaligned here today, and I'm not a business rep. I'm only political, so I'd like him to make a few comments, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Identify.
My name is Tim Fowle, and I work for Oregon AFSCME, Council 75, and essentially what I do is negotiate and enforce contracts in various state and municipal and private sector businesses and agencies. I've represented the employees at real estate for a little over a year now, and the subject of this bill is of intense interest to them, and there's been more than a little controversy in the agency about how enforcement should happen. I actually think the realtors are right in many points. It needs to be clarified, and I've seen Commissioner Taylor make major efforts along those lines over the last year, and I see record of having it happen over the last couple of years. The employees, particularly in the regulatory division, which is what we're talking about here, take it to heart that the agency's mission is to protect the consumer. They see themselves as the only line of defense between the disreputable element in the industry, which is, no one questions, a very small minority, and what is largely an uninformed and inexperienced public. I bought a house once. I signed about 9 yards of paperwork, all of which was fine print. And sure, I could have taken that paperwork in and hired an attorney to look at it for me, but like most consumers, I didn't. I relied on the integrity of the realtor and the integrity of the title company, and by golly, it worked out great. I also want to say that I'm not a realtor basher. My father was a realtor. All indications so far is that he was an honest man. So, but this bill has some flaws in it from the point of view of the people I represent. The biggest flaw is that it clarifies where the bar is at too low a level. The primary objection I heard from everybody I talked to about this over there, investigators, was that it removes their ability to investigate patterns of behavior. What frequently happens is that they'll be investigating someone who has had a number of complaints that weren't substantiated, but they were similar. When that happens, the investigators I represent absolutely go through those books with a comb. They look hard. Because again, they understand that they're dealing with, on the one hand, fairly sophisticated individuals in their industry, and on the other hand, a public that has no knowledge of escrow laws or title, chains of title, or what closing requirements are, or what liens are. Liens are not a little shed that you stack your firewood up in. Most people think otherwise. This, by limiting to the single complaint, removes the ability of the professional investigator to pursue the underlying concern. One of the things I've noticed is that in the pieces of testimony I've heard today and the pieces that have been reported to me on my way down here, was that nobody's produced an innocent man wronged. Is it a pain in the rear to have to open your books to a regulator? Absolutely. Has anyone produced the realtor who lost their license unfairly?
Mr. Chair, can I jump right in here?
Yeah,
first of all, it's always good to see my union brothers and sisters in the room defending workers and wages and hours and benefits and working conditions, which I care so much about. But, sir, I really have to, if everything the gentleman right back there said is true, and I have no reason to think it isn't, he had a letter sent to him saying he's in violation. He was fined. The fine was gotten rid of, if I remember. They were threatened to revoke his license. Then they said, no, we're going to reduce the fine or something. And then they exonerated him completely. But they were going to put a permanent mark on his record. Now, that's wrong. If someone does their homework, which you're right, most time home buyers don't. If someone does their homework and looks, and they're looking for a reputable realtor, and they see a mark on his record, they're going to go through to the next person. Now, that's going to hurt his business for something that he had nothing to do with. Now, I've been involved in dry rot removal. And you can cover up all kinds of things if you are that kind of contractor. I'm not that kind of contractor, but you could. And realtors don't put their overalls on, climb under the crawl space, and look. Now, in my opinion, sir, that gentleman was wronged. Now, I would like you to explain to me how you, after you're sitting in this room listening to him, say he was not wronged.
Representative, I didn't hear it, but I'm going to take your story as straightforward.
I'd like you to explain.
It was a dry rot story. Oregon tries to protect consumers. It protects consumers in a number of ways.
I don't want a big dissertation.
So let me give it to you short.
I want to tell you to tell me from the story I just told you.
Right.
And with all due respect to you and the people you represent, I want you to explain to me how that gentleman was not wrong when he has a permanent negative mark on his record for something he's been exonerated of.
Is there a permanent mark on his record now? Because if not, I would submit that the process protected him. It was painful, but at the end of it, he was clean.
Well,
and his record so reflects.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll say it quick. Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, in all due respect, I learned through years of serving on boards that I always wanted to hear both sides, and all I will say to you is I'd like you to hear both sides to that, and that'll mean if that's the case, then I assume your real estate commissioner is here, and that's the appropriate person to ask that.
Thank you, sir.
Better answer than mine. Sorry, I get a little hot.
Thank you. Is that...
I would urge you to take a real hard look at where the consumer protection is coming from. This is a profession that makes good efforts to educate its members, but it doesn't regulate itself. There's not a bar association equivalent or a board of medical examiners or an Oregon Board of Nursing equivalent. There needs to be some place the public can take their complaints and be sure that they're going to be thoroughly investigated.
Mr. Chair, briefly, I agree with everything you said. And this is one of those bills where I think maybe people should have talked a lot more about before they brought it in, everybody involved in this, before it was brought into this room. Rather than everybody getting in a fight here in this room, I would rather people figured out their differences, tried to clarify the law, make it better so that the consumers, workers are protected. But you know what? Instead, it's drug in here, and this is what happens, and that kind of frustrates me. And I'm not blaming you guys.
It's okay if you do.
I appreciate that.
I mean anybody.
I share your frustration. Yeah. I shouldn't be here. I should be home in bed.
Me too.
Thank you for coming and testifying. Just to follow up on Representative Schaffler's comments there, I do believe I heard earlier in the testimony that this discussion was going on 12 months ago, mm-hmm. and that we have white papers in here to that effect.
I'd like to report a transaction that we've had with Real Estate Agency. About a year and a half ago, one of our investigators had apparently a series of complaints made about her to the chairman. That resulted in a meeting between OAR representatives and the chairman, we think, where this was discussed. We asked for copies of the minutes of that meeting because of two reasons. One, we had a member who we thought was under direct attack by the industry that she was in charge of investigating. And two, we saw some implications to collective bargaining in how complaints about our members were being processed. So we asked for those minutes in two forms. We asked for them under the public information laws, and we asked for them under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. The public information request is still pending. The commissioner was reluctant to release that information, and he tells us, and I believe him, out of respect for the industry he has to deal with, that he felt he was approached in confidence about serious problems, and there was a records conflict there. We took our complaint under PECPA to a hearings officer at the Employment Relations Board under an unfair labor practice, and we prevailed. The state has since appealed that to the full board, who has heard the case, and we're waiting for a determination from the Employment Relations Board. But the order that came out of the hearings officer reflects a process that already separates investigation from recommendation. None of the investigators is in charge of deciding whether a penalty should be assessed. That is above them in the chain of command. They gather information, and no doubt zealously. There have been criticisms of some of their performance within the agency by their managers, and they have modified their performance in many cases. At least two that I'm aware of have quit because they believed that the controls over their investigatory performance put the citizens they were charged with protecting at risk. And they did the ethical thing. Once that dispute was clearly defined, they left employment. Very experienced people. I think they're a loss, but there's a question of balance here.
Mr. Chair,
there's already balance.
One last comment to your question. I want to comment to your direct question, Mr. Chair. I can only tell you that House Bill 2604 was presented me 2 days ago by Tim Fowle. the mistake agencies make in general, and I won't go through that. I've got about eight of them that have done it, and then they end up losing a bill. So you have a good point, and that is that I was not involved ever in this process of this bill. I'm the lobbyist that has, really, not that that's a big deal, but I am the lobbyist that has, one of my numerous assignments is real estate. The only time I had this discussed with me was my own staff who said, you need to go talk to the real estate commissioner, which I did, so that this is all on the record, just yesterday or the day before. I don't want you to think that that's not my style. My style is always to negotiate out problems and try to... I put together the group on building codes called the Construction Industry Policy Board of Oregon, and now we don't have fights with business and labor. We work cooperatively. I would hope we'd have the same kind of thing happen with realtors and at least with us, and we bring common interests together. We're not a hardball, take it to you kind of group. We're pretty darn decent, and I know some on the committee will disagree, but we like you all, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, I assure Mr. Groner, no one up here would ever question his decency or ability to lobby his cause in a fine, nice, courteous, mannerly way.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Let's see, what's the kids wanted us to... could we have Mr. Taylor, please?
Oh, yeah. I think it's, what is it, 27, right?
27,
right?
Oh, where is it?
Sector 7.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Taylor. I am the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner. My right is Becky Osborne, who is our regulations manager and has been for about the last year. I'll pull the arrows out here for a moment and give you a little bit of my background before I begin, because I think that'll give you a little feel as to who I am. I first got my real estate license in 1976, and I've owned and managed one office and managed two others, actually, in Representative Esquivel and Representative Gilman's hometown of Medford, though I think Mr. Gilman's really from Central Point. I was the 1988 president of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I was their Realtor of the Year in 1989. I've been an officer in the National Association of Realtors, and like Mr. Harris, I am also a certified professional standards instructor. In fact, I was the first one in Oregon. In 1989, I also became qualified to teach Realtors Risk Management and develop the courses that were taught through the early 90s. I've been involved in virtually every piece of legislation regarding license law sponsored by OAR since 1987 until my appointment as commissioner. I had been a respondent before the real estate agency and a complaint against my office, and I've also been sued as a result of the same transaction. I will tell you that my experience in 1985 wasn't very pleasant either. I can tell you that myself, one of my associates, and my two partners were all offered suspensions, and we walked out of there with one of those letters that you've heard referred to. I don't think that's a good process, but that process has been in place for a long time, and I'll get back to that in a bit. I've also been a complainant to the real estate agency as a broker against the activities of another licensee in a transaction where my office was the selling agent and the licensee was the seller. This happened, we filed this complaint about a year before I came to the agency, and it had not been investigated when I came to the agency. And about 8 months later, when the case finally went to hearing, which I had to recuse myself from, two of the witnesses that could have convicted the broker had died. So I'm very concerned about the timeliness of our investigators. I was appointed the commissioner by the governor in 1995. Additionally, I am the immediate past president of the Association of Real Estate License Law Officials, that it's an organization that is comprised of real estate regulatory jurisdictions in 16 countries. I say that because the problems that you're hearing here today are not unique to Oregon. And I've been among those folks, so I know that that's true. I'm not a career government administrator. I'm a career real estate broker. I think like a broker. I told my colleagues in the real estate business that when I quit thinking like a broker, I wish one of them would tell me because I'll retire. This is the first time I've ever testified in opposition to an OAR bill, and it's with a heavy heart that I do it. I believe the bill does lower the standards by which real estate professionals are held and hampers the ability of the agency to properly police those who are causing harm to the consumer and the industry. I don't believe OAR or the licensed community as a whole really wants that. Let me talk about some of the problems that have led up to this bill. In 2000, our existing procedure where the real estate commissioner was the hearing officer was superseded by the hearing officer panel. In the 15 years prior to 2000, in my experience, we have averaged about 15 hearings a year before the commissioner. Since 2000, we've had a total of 6 involving real estate licensees of the 58 that were filed. Over 98% of our cases result in settlements. Many of these, the licensees are in litigation, and we're working with attorneys who want facts and violations altered because of the civil situation. My concerns when we became in the hearing officer panel were several, and I elicited them then, and I believe many of these have become true. And I think some of this is the genesis of the problem we have today. First was I was afraid that the system wouldn't be used, and I think that's been demonstrated. 6 in 5 years. I was afraid that the process that we're involved in resolving disputes would become politicized, and I believe it has. I was afraid that there would be a backlash from the industry because they did not have that recourse to the commissioner that they had in the past. One of my good friends in the industry said to me once, he said, "You know, I'd rather be hung by somebody that knows what I'm doing than by somebody that doesn't." And I think that feeling continues today. And finally, our cases can be somewhat difficult, and it's more difficult for a non-expert hearing officer to do them. So that's one part. Mandatory arbitration is a part of most real estate agreements, and there's been a problem with that resulting in bad decisions, and those decisions do not become appellate decisions, and they don't get to develop any case law. We've had literally no real estate case law in Oregon since this process started. And I know it's frustrating for the industry, and that what happens to us is litigants file complaints with the real estate agency for discovery. Now, there was a question brought up earlier about a situation where it was stated that we were supporting the suppression of evidence. I'd like to categorically state that that is not true. There was a concept that was put before us that would put what I call a disconnect between the evidence of a violation being evidence of something that's happening in civil court. We don't feel that the two are inclusive. They should be exclusive. And that evidence, I would agree. However, the evidence in the file would be readily available to anybody, and those folks can make their case based on that evidence. Another problem that is of the business, and you heard it a little bit when you heard this situation about insurance this morning, is the business model. It is an independent contractor, statutory non-employee versus employee system that has gone on for years. And one of the problems that this presents is a large firm, a lot of times they don't have consistency within their firm and how their people do their business, and that sometimes results in complaints to us. I want to give you some data here, and hopefully that'll help you as we go through. Historically, 80% of the written complaints that are submitted to the agency in this last 12 months, we've had just under 500 of those, are dismissed without opening the case at all for no apparent violation after follow-up or for a lack of jurisdiction. Of the real estate complaint files we open and investigate fully, historically, 38% of them we don't find a violation. 32% of them receive what we call an educational advisory letter, and 30% of them receive some sort of administrative action. In the years 2000 to 2004, the administrative actions involving real estate licensees, 66% of them resulted in reprimands, 22% resulted in suspensions, and 12% resulted in revocations. I give you those because I believe we do have a progressive discipline system installed in the agency today. In 2004, we've had 36 reprimands, 13 suspensions, and 3 revocations. The complaints, and I'm really pleased to say this, have been at a historic low in 2004, as have the administrative actions. 2001 was the high during my tenure. I attribute much of that to the recent changes in the license law that this body did 2 sessions ago. ORS 696015, in its legislative findings, says the real estate license law is enacted to create for the public a healthy real estate market atmosphere and to assure that professional real estate activity is conducted with high fiduciary standards. To the bill. We were first made aware of the potential for this bill when I read the most recent publication of the Oregon Realtor. Now, I will admit that I was at those seminars that happened and I was a panelist in one. However, I was not aware that legislation was being developed, nor was I brought in and consulted or discussed it. I believe I read that publication in mid-January. I met with OAR staff and walked away with the impression that the bill wasn't that big of a deal and that the association walked hand-in-hand with the agency should a bill come to pass. I offered to make myself available to leadership, the executive committee, and OAR's legislative committee at any time. To date, I've not been invited to discuss the bill with any of these membership groups. The real estate agency first saw the bill on February 23rd when it was available for download after its introduction, which I believe was on February 22nd. On February 22nd, when I became aware the bill was being introduced, as we had a real estate board meeting that morning, I asked one member of the board who was on OAR Executive Committee and another who you heard from earlier who chairs the OAR Legislative Committee and I believe also sits on Executive Committee if they'd seen a draft of the bill, and to which they both responded they had not. We met with 2 members of OAR staff on February 25th and again on March 16th. The first time I spoke with a member of OAR leadership about the bill was on the phone with OAR President Cynthia Balzola March 15th. I was approached yesterday by a member of, I believe, the OAR Legislative Committee who asked about my take on the bill as he heard I'd had concerns about the bill. Since I've been commissioner, we've worked long before the introduction of any bill either of us was contemplating affecting license law, with the approach that we always wanted to go into the legislature together if at all possible. This new approach does not pass the smell test for me, and it makes me very wary about what the bill is. Section 1. First, I would like to say, when you read this bill and what the bill intends to do, I support it completely. It's like motherhood and the flag as far as I'm concerned, and I think what it purports to do is a good thing, and I support the concept entirely. I want that very clear.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You're Mr. Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, I just want to, in the essence of time, you'd said that you did participate in the panel. I guess it was the 15th and 16th of 2004. That's correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitz, I was a member of that panel. That's correct.
And at that time, the panel was discussing their potential legislative agenda for the upcoming legislative session, which would have taken place 8 months later.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitz, the panel that I sat on was basically a discussion about what the agency did and that sort of a thing. I was not aware at that point that this was what was coming.
So, follow-up, if I might?
Follow-up.
So, the Oregon Association of Realtors 2004 Legislative Conference research paper and proposed legislation that was discussed at this panel, you didn't see that as coming forward? You just thought it was a discussion at the time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitz, that's exactly correct. The resultant of that meeting was given to me when I met with the CEO of the association shortly after reading that article I spoke of.
Follow-up on that?
Follow-up.
Okay. At that time, when these ideas that were being discussed to come forward to the legislature, whether or not they were in your mind going to come to the legislature or not, or let's just say hypothetically for the sake of argument, they were just discussion points at a conference. Did you voice your opposition at that time to these proposed ideas?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitz, the proposed ideas did not come forward at that conference.
So they were never discussed?
Not in my presence.
So the first follow-up, if I might?
Follow-up.
So the first that you heard of these proposed ideas that we're discussing here today, I'm just following the time frame, were February 22nd of this year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitz, the first I was aware of the proposed ideas, concepts, if you will, was when I read the Oregon Realtor, which I discussed, I thought was in January. The first I saw the proposal was February 23rd. I might add that if you read the Oregon Realtor, and I, in my analysis, I quoted the section. It's not real specific.
One final follow-up, if I might. So, at what point did you, I think it's very important, at what point did you articulate your opposition to these? What was the first point in time when you articulated your opposition to OAR, either publicly or privately?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitz, that was on February 25th.
February 25th. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead and give your testimony, sir.
Okay. Speaking to Section 1 of the bill, and I won't take much time with that, this is something the agency currently allows. We don't think there's a statutory prohibition right now. It's been in our frequently asked questions on the website for about a year. We don't have a problem with that section. We think we have the authority to do it in a rule, but if the association prefers in the law, I'm not going to argue with that.
So you're all right in Section 1, then?
We're all right in Section 1. Section 2 concerns us, as we simply don't think the proposal solves the problem. And it puts what we believe should be a transactional issue in real estate license law. It should be straightforwardly bargained between the parties. I think it eliminates a licensee's ability to try and resolve a dispute amicably, forcing it to litigation. Plus, if the licensee forgets to discuss it with the seller, it could place the licensee at risk. With this in statute, as a seller, I would always insist earnest money be placed in escrow. Section 3 is an area where we do have some issues. It attempts to condense 33 violations into 12, and that's a concept that we wholeheartedly support. However, having just received the bill, we want to be sure of its impact and whether it's as comprehensive as it's been represented. We don't believe it is. We've had serious concerns about replacing the word negligence with gross negligence and reckless. We believe this lowers the bar on licensees' performance that has been long established. I've spoken briefly with the Attorney General's office on this, and they haven't had time to examine this bill yet. They just simply haven't had time. But they had two questions. One is that this does appear to establish a new threshold.
And the second is that as it's currently written, it may eliminate some problems that were brought into the section last session addressing a case known as Dearborn versus the real estate agency that affect every licensing agency, actually. Negligence, though not currently defined in our statute, and I believe it should be, is generally the failure to use prudent care, where gross negligence is to willingly and wantonly act with reckless disregard for the consequences. I'd suggest those are two very different concepts. Our statute is not directed at consequences, it's directed at conduct. In other words, it's the act that causes the law violation, not the consequences of the act. Consequences are factors that enter into determining a sanction, if any. To determine that it's a consequence is the test for determining whether a violation occurred, no harm, no foul, is a concept dealt with in the civil court system, not a regulatory scheme as we have. 696.301(1), describing misrepresentation, also expresses this concept because instead of requiring actual damage or injury, it requires a reasonable probability of damage or injury. I'd submit that same concept applies to negligent acts. Many acts real estate licensees may do in the course of their business may very well cause significant damage or injury if they're not conducted with prudent care. Notwithstanding the other proposed changes to this section of our statute, this concept is, I believe, at the heart of our disagreement over this section. The rest needs careful consideration, and we need to work with our counsel at the AG's office in considering these changes. Again, because the bill was dropped on us at such a late date, this work has not been possible. It may be something we should be doing in the interim. I believe this apparent change from emphasis on conduct to requiring consequences not only lowers the bar, it places the consumer and the licensee at greater risk. If someone's held to a standard of acting prudently in their conduct rather than acting with reckless disregard for the consequences, they're much less likely to cause harm, in my opinion. It's preventive, and that's what this law has been all about in the 29 years that I've been around it. That's conducting one's professional activity with high fiduciary standards. The mission statement of the agency has included the words to protect the consumer for decades. In discussions over this section with OAR staff, I heard one staff member say more than once that the emphasis on the consumer in the statement is essentially an outmoded concept because consumers are now represented with an agent. I was shocked to hear that. Though buyer agency only became popular in the early 1990s in Oregon, sellers have always been represented, and they're consumers too. So I think the consumer is still a part of the equation and should always be. If these concepts are to change, they require thorough, extended discussion with numerous groups to achieve consensus and buy-in. I don't believe that can happen by merely slamming a bill through. Section 5, as written, seriously limits our ability to do our job of investigating licensee conduct. First, it requires a written complaint, which implies that if the commissioner learns a licensee is under investigation by or is arrested by a law enforcement authority, or if a licensee is convicted of a crime substantially related to a licensee's trustworthiness or fitness for licensing, the commissioner is powerless to investigate unless someone files a written complaint. We have a situation in McMinnville that's achieved national attention where a number of individuals have allegedly been involved in defrauding members of the Hispanic community. To date, 84 victims have been identified and 3 real estate licensees have been indicted for loan fraud. I believe of the 70-plus licensees and numerous escrow companies involved in some manner, there are 7 licensees the agency is pursuing sanctions against and potentially 1 escrow company. We received no written complaint in this case. This section also limits the scope of the investigation to the truth or falsity of the facts alleged in the complaint. I call that the anti-witch hunt provision. Some time ago, we received a complaint from a client of a property manager alleging that because the licensee had not collected a proper security deposit, and because the licensee had failed to visit the property as was specified in the management agreement, the property suffered damage from a tenant, and there were not funds to make the repairs. That was the complaint. When we receive complaints against property managers, we always look at their trust accounts because of the problems we find there. And in this case, we found the account was about $125,000 short. Law enforcement authorities become involved in this case, and criminal prosecution took place as well as our revoking the license. We would not have been able to redress this if we were limited to the scope of the complaint. I think the industry wants us involved in these situations. This section also talks about conducting investigations in a fair and unbiased manner, and who can determine investigation, progressive discipline, etc. The agency wholeheartedly supports these concepts. You've heard about today where this has not taken place. I'm aware of the Robertson case. In fact, the Robertson case horrified me when I first heard about it, and it still does, frankly. And that's when the discussions began with the industry that I'll talk with Mr. Fowle, I think, alleged to him earlier. You will not hear from the nearly 400 complainants whose complaints against licensees we chose not to investigate regarding how they might feel their complaints were handled this year. I suspect a number of them aren't happy either. I've heard these same types of concerns over the years, and in March of 2003, I met with an industry group to discuss our investigation process. That was the meeting that resulted in the unfair trade or labor practice. These discussions, along with our new regulations division manager brought with him, resulted in changes to our procedures and the development of an investigator's handbook. I've handed you Chapter 10 of the Real Estate Manual, which sets out these procedures. This was published in August 2003, and if you read it, you'll see it embodies much of what is in this section. These procedures should not be in a licensing statute or required by a licensing statute to be in a rule, in our opinion. I'm informed by the Attorney General's office that this would be a precedent. I'm not aware of another licensing statute like ours that has these requirements set out in such a manner. If that's what OAR wants to do, it should be a general statute that addresses the internal procedures of all professional licensing agencies. If one or more agency employees is acting against these procedures, it's a personnel matter. Putting it in statute won't make it any less a personnel matter. It won't make it any different, nor will it prevent unacceptable behavior. In our discussions with OAR staff, the tax practitioner's law has been used as an example. I've attached that in your materials. I don't see anything in their law resembling what's proposed here. But there is a section regarding educational remedies that I do like that we occasionally do in settlement agreements, though it's not in statute. In February 2003, OAR published in its Broker Bites a seeking information piece that said, "Have you had problems with certain real estate agency investigators or agency discipline or procedures? If so, we'd like to hear about it." So would I. I can't address personnel issues if I don't know about it. I asked OAR CEO and General Counsel Andrea Bushnell on more than one occasion after this came out what she's received. I've received nothing usable as a result of it. Personnel matters require documentation and proof, much like allegations of licensee misconduct. The agency will not tolerate improper employee conduct, nor do I believe will their union. But we need proof. This section also addresses what I would call progressive discipline. We do this now. We've done it so in the nearly 10 years that I've been at the agency. Speaking with the AG's office, again, they're not aware of a situation where the disciplinary process is set out in a three strikes, you're out, or whatever you want to call this system type of a manner. I think the fact that 32% of our investigations result in advisory letters, not administrative action, and of the 30% of our investigations where administrative action occurs, over half result in reprimands bears this out. However, putting this process in statute unnecessarily constricts the ability to use it. The summer I was appointed, I read a book called The Death of Common Sense. It talks about overcodification and how it stifles people's ability to use common sense in approaching things we deal with where laws are involved. That book, Catch-22, and Alice in Wonderland have influenced how I've come to approach things. Our approach with six, our concerns with Section 6 and 7 of the bill are that they are merely that the language is simply too broad. Investigation, as it's stated there, is defined nowhere in our statute. I was taught that laws should be written with a degree of precision that a person reading in bad faith can't understand, misunderstand it. I believe this wording could be read to say, a licensee has no obligation to observe and act on red flags when inspecting a property while listing it or while showing it. I don't think this is their intent. The language needs to be tightened up. In no stretch of the imagination would I ever suggest, nor do I think would my investigators, that a licensee should be crawling houses or the like. Section 8 does not say what I believe the association means. You heard two people talk about unlicensed activity and the civil fines that were levied against them. I know what the industry wants, and we support that. We believe this also could be spelled out in rule. However, we have a problem here, and this problem, we have almost as many folks can't seem to remember when to renew their license as we do that we deal with administrative actions every year. It's a problem, and it's a problem that can adversely affect a broker because that licensee is operating under that broker's errors and omissions insurance, which, because of the litigation, by the way, has gone through the roof. And I don't know of an errors and omissions policy that will cover the errors or omissions of an unlicensed person acting in the capacity of a licensed person. I personally had this happen to me as a broker, where one of my licensees hadn't renewed her license for almost a year, and I wasn't aware of it. Now, part of that's my fault. However, in this situation, we'd been involved in a dispute over one of her transactions, and today I'm thanking God we didn't get sued, because I can't imagine what would have happened should it have happened. So we take this very seriously. We're trying to find a situation or a method whereby it's fair to the licensee, but it also gets them to the position where they're not going to do it again. And you have different licensees doing different things. The statute, as it's currently written, has an entry level of 100 to a 500 for a first event offense of unlicensed activity, 500 to a 1,000 for the next event, and another section says that you can also take whatever it is they profited. Now, that section was really written towards folks that are out there that are operating without a license, that have never had a license. But it's the only thing that we have to work with at present with folks that had a license and didn't renew it, and now they don't have a license. They're unlicensed. The bar treats this seriously. We treat it seriously. We're more than happy to work with the industry to come up with a solution. I know Mr. Rice personally. I know he's not a bad actor. He does a lot of business. And that went into the thinking here. What we did, and I'll be real honest about it, when we realized this was the concern it was, because I hadn't had this discussion with the industry prior to the bill coming out in any measure to speak of, we said, let's go back and do what we've been doing before, which is also not set out in statute, and base the thing on the number of months or parts thereof that they were unlicensed. But there is no justification for doing that in our current statute. So I think what they proposed, again, working out the details, because I think they meant to put a cap on it, and they didn't, is something we can support. You may hear, I don't think you did, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Mr. Chair?
I'm almost done.
Well, I apologize. I'm done, too. I have to leave for another meeting in another city, but I just wanted to make a comment before I leave. It seems that, you know, I'd hate to be in your shoes at this time. I can appreciate the gravity of the situation, but, you know, it seems like you're in the middle of a big problem here where you have industry on one side that's not happy with the way things are being administered, and you have obviously some great staff and investigators, and it doesn't seem like the fairness of our statutes are being delivered. And, you know, if there's a problem with the statutes that you've been aware of, I would have thought that, you know, your agency would have brought these forward before this has come to this point. And I would hope that the communication stays open, that you can get some people from your investigators and from industry to figure out what needs to happen to fix this situation. It's very frustrating sitting here listening to you go on about this and not really addressing the issues that I've heard come up here today. So thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Finish your testimony with you will, please, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You haven't heard that the industry put the agency disclosure requirements that we passed in 1993 in statute because they didn't trust the agency to do it right. It is a true statement, and I'm the one that said it. As I mentioned before, the agency and the realtors did not have a dialogue in those days. That was as much the fault of the industry as it was of the agency. When I came to the agency, I was determined that dialogue would begin and would continue. That was not met without criticism at the agency, and I've been criticized by my staff many times for being too close to the industry. I believe it's doing the right thing, and I'll continue to do so in spite of our differences over this bill. I've made it a mark of my administration to be out and be seen by licensees. I speak or appear just about anywhere when asked, and have provided education seminars for licensees all over the state, averaging about 60 clock hours of instruction annually, not counting travel time. Unfortunately, the agency was not brought into the development of this bill, and Representative Schaffler, that's why we're here at odds over it today.
Good. Thank you.
The agency can't support the bill in its present form, and we must therefore regretfully oppose it. I'm happy to answer your question.
President Schaffler.
Thank you. I've never met you before. I don't think you're probably not an evil guy or anything like that. But clearly, I didn't wake up this morning. I don't think a realtor association, you know, said, well, we want to screw with the statute one day. And I certainly didn't wake up this morning and say, well, I'm going to go bash some public employees. I know if anybody's done their homework, they know I didn't do that. But, you know, I do want you to clearly there's something going on here, or it wouldn't be this. We wouldn't be having this hearing. And nobody wants to protect the consumer more than we do. But I want you to specifically, the gentleman spoke earlier about no one had come forth and pointed out that someone had been wronged. Well, I want you to specifically address Mr. Robertson, I believe it is, and he's talked about common sense. Now, this gentleman's notified that he's in violation of something, goes through all this, you know, it must have been an incredibly frustrating and nerve-wracking process. He's fully exonerated by your agency. Your agency, according to him, and maybe he's not telling the truth, but in all likelihood, he probably is. Your agency says, well, we're going to put a black mark on your record. It's going to be distributed throughout the state in our newsletter. Now, first of all, is Mr. Robertson telling the truth? And secondly, where is the common sense in that? And I can't believe that happened. And maybe it's not very frequent, but obviously things like this are happening to a frequency that brought these folks here today with this bill. Now, I just want that specific case spelled out. And then to explain, you know, your take on why we're here today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I will speak to that. I think Mr. Robertson was wronged in this situation. In fact, it was Mr. Robertson's situation that brought this whole issue to our attention. The agency prior to that had operated under a set of circumstances and policies that were again published in a manual, much as the ones I've given you, that were quite different. As a result of those policies, it allowed what happened to Mr. Robertson, whom I know very well, actually, and he's not a bad guy, and he's not lying, allowed that situation to happen. I mentioned before that I'd been in a very similar situation many years ago. That's how long that process had gone on, and frankly, we hadn't received any complaints about it to speak of, about the process, until Mr. Robertson's case. And we did get in, and we worked, and I'm willing to continue to work with the industry on this to get the thing resolved. I don't think it's fully resolved. Regarding the mark on Mr. Robertson's record, the mark on his record merely says that at one point he had an advisory letter. It did not get published statewide. It's in the record. Says those are advisory. It doesn't say that he did anything wrong. It only said, and the way they're written today, subsequent to Mr. Robertson's situation, it is intended to be informative and educational. Mr. Robertson's situation, I first became aware of it in December of 2002. So, and those policies you see today are August 2003. Many of those were developed as a result of that meeting that I had with the industry. Did I answer?
Thank you.
Representative Eskel.
One fix, maybe, Mr. Commissioner, is on the license status. Why don't we go ahead and send it simultaneously to the brokerage and then send them a secondary final notice as well as the individual? We have that capability. We should be doing so. That's just the first suggestion. Just think about it. The other thing is, I think we need to get back and find out what the real original intent of the real estate agency was. Are we there for the public? Are we there for the real estate community? Or are we there for both? When I call the agency, I always get the impression that I'm a problem in interrupting their work. And I see a lot of heads in the background that are doing this. I don't know why, because it's my dues that support the agency. It's my concern with the public is why I pay my licensing fees. The other thing is, I agree when people do something terribly wrong, they should not practice in the state of Oregon. But I have seen cases where we have taken, and I'm not laying anything on that I haven't discussed with you before here, because you and I have known each other since we were kids. We had an individual that turned in another individual that forged a document, which was a contract. Flat forged the name. Now, the individual that turned them in, it reminded me of watching a murder. I parked on the side of the road. The policeman came, arrested the individual that committed the murder, and then cited me because I had a taillight out. Because we ended up giving an advisory letter to the individual that turned them in because they had missed a date on a document, even though it had been faxed with the time and the date at the top of the document. The individual that forged the contract got a six-month suspension. That individual should never, ever have practiced real estate in the state of Oregon, ever, because of forgery. But we talk about common sense here. Let's talk about common sense. When we have things that are coming in front of us, that's not common sense. That is not, and my concern is, who's running the organization here? That's what really disturbs me here. Because I see people coming in, even to this day, and the one that I just quoted you about, the individual that was cited for not putting a date on a document, happened some time ago. But the things that I'm seeing here today is that we're actually going in, building a big case here, saying, okay, you have your choice. You have curtain A or curtain B. Curtain A is you're going to pay $10,000.
B is, we'll settle for 600 if you capitulate. So I look at this as we have an inherent problem here. How can we fix it?
Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Representative Esquivel, could I comment just briefly?
Glad to.
After discussing that one incident with you Wednesday, I went back and looked at the case. And the case did happen prior to all of these events that we've heard about that caused the agency to take a look at what it was doing. I'm happy to tell you that that individual has nothing on her record. And I think what happened then, which would not be our practice today, is the cover letter mentioned that the issue that was raised regarding her was not an issue. However, it was shown up in the investigator's report, which was sent to her, as I believe. Today, that wouldn't even happen in her situation. So there's a bit of a difference there. Regarding the piling on of violations or that kind of a thing, part of the problem we have there is part of the problem that OAR and we would like to resolve with Section 3. There's 33 ways you can lose your license today. There ought to be about 13, I think. Because of the way they're set out and because of the administrative procedures rules that we have to do, in order to put the thing before a hearing officer and give them the ability, if the facts placed before them in a hearing, for them to find a lesser charge if they think that is most appropriate, we must charge them all. And the case for that is Villanueva versus the psychologists, as I recall. It requires us to do that. I don't like it, because I think what happened to Mr. Robertson is where people go into apoplexy. As you see something here, and I did a couple, three things, and there's 19 violations attached to it. And really, there may have been two or three things that were wrong. I completely agree with him.
Mr. Taylor, I think I want to thank you for coming and testifying today, and we've certainly got far from the talking about a bill. But I'm going to close the hearing and wrap it up for the day. We've used up all the time that's allowed to us. And thank you very much, Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules and allow Representative Schaffer to vote on 2719.
First, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill, well, I even lost track of what it was, 2604. And Representative Gilman asks that we... moves that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Schaffer to vote on House Bill 2719. Is there any objection? Seeing none, how does Representative Schaffer vote?
Aye.
Representative Schaffer votes aye on House Bill 2719.
Thank you.
Was there another one? Nope. What did we do with 2097?
Okay. Well, I hope we get together and talk it out.
Just announcement. 8:30 Monday, probably 8 o'clock on Wednesday, but 8:30 Monday.
Are we going to do any nighttime stuff?
Next week.
I can hardly wait.
And we are adjourned.
Thank you, Chairman Brown.